Darren Bonoff, we're going to start momentarily. Okay. Morning, everyone. The Senate Education Committee will come to order. Today's Thursday, March 12, 2015. It's 8 a.m. We're in room 107 at the state capitol. We have a few bills before us. First, Senate File 97, Senator Bonoff. Welcome, and we'll ask you to have testifiers gather around, and we are going to devote the next 30 minutes to your presentation. There's an author's amendment, which we'll let you address, and we'll entertain that motion when we have a quorum, but we will include that for our discussion now. So, welcome, Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's it's early. We start quick before a quorum. So, anyways, the amendment is being passed out. So first of all, thank you to the committee and Chair Wieger for giving this bill an opportunity to be heard. There has been much written in the last several weeks about the bill that I'm here to present. Senate File 97 proposes to alter a process that has been longstanding and highly controversial. This bill proposes to use teacher performance as the lead criteria when making teacher retention decisions. This issue has been discussed and debated for many years in the state of Minnesota. We are an outlier as only one of only 10 states that continue to have the policy of basing teacher retention solely on the factors of service. Some of you might recall President Obama coming to our state in 2011 when he invited the former Teacher of the Year, Lisa Bruska, to join him. She had been let go immediately after receiving her Teacher of the Year award. That stood out to me as a particularly poignant time where Minnesota had been singled out for having what I consider a backwards education policy. There's actually, in your packets, there's the CARE 11 story about that particular incident. What you might not know is that 25 years before, in 1991, the same thing happened to Kathy Nelson, a Teacher of the Year recipient who was fired by Fridley because she didn't have as many years in the school as the four other social studies teachers. That article was in the New York Times, and it, too, is in your packets. Keep in mind that Kathy had been there for 13 years. So these were not young people fresh out of school. They were experienced and proven teachers who were effective and had the awards to prove it. They just happened to be hired after their counterparts. Their stories highlight the pervasive nature of this outdated policy. This proposal is not about valuing young people over old people. It is about keeping the very best and most effective teachers in the classroom. And more than anything else, it's about serving our students to our best ability. I believe this issue represents an important civil right. In fact, it became a central piece in a lawsuit settled in the California courts when a group sued the state claiming that this exact policy was unconstitutional. They won. The courts ruled that low-income students were put at a disadvantage because often those students were placed with a disproportionately high number of low-performing teachers and therefore hurting their ability to be academically successful. We have heard clearly that if we don't act this session, there will be a similar court case in Minnesota. We have an opportunity to address this issue with a legislative vote this session and not a legal challenge. I implore us to take that action. This past Saturday, I spent a good part of the day watching the events in Selma, Alabama. I was enthralled with the significance of the day. I listened intently to President Obama and was very inspired. President Obama did not only speak of racial inequity and triumph, but he talked of the spirit of Americans overcoming inequity and experiencing triumph. Please allow me to just quote a few passages from his remarks. What greater expression of faith in the American experiment than this, than the belief that America is not yet finished, that we are strong enough to be self-critical, that each successive generation can look upon our imperfections and decide that it is in our power to remake this nation to more closely align with our highest ideals. And then he went on to say, loving this country requires more than singing its praises or avoiding uncomfortable truths. It requires the occasional disruption, the willingness to speak out for what's right and to shake up the status quo. We can do this, members. I'm not equating this issue to the severity of the problems addressed by our nation 50 years ago, but the words are still relevant. Often you hear people talk about our current achievement gap is one of the civil rights issues of our time. Because we are failing a generation of young people. This failure is our failure, our collective community failure. It is not the school's failure, and it certainly is not teachers' failure. We must put a stop to this and use every available tool to address this systemic challenge. Leaving a teacher layoff structure in place that does not demand the highest performing teachers be placed in our classrooms is akin to neglect. What rationale could possibly be used to say seniority is more important than teacher performance? We say we want a diverse teacher population in our classrooms, yet our very policies pink slip our newly recruited teachers of color. We know there has been a technological revolution that allows us to address each and every unique student in uniquely effective ways, and yet our policies have the potential to wipe out the technologically adept teachers from having the opportunity to transform their building culture. I have quoted our president in my remarks today. Our president and Secretary Duncan have been on record for championing policies that place teacher performance as the first criteria for hiring, firing, and retention decisions. Recently, Illinois passed their own version of this that they called the Performance Evaluation Reform Act. And Secretary Duncan remarked, Illinois has created a powerful framework to strengthen the teaching profession and advance student learning. I am joined today by a few who will be the voice of the many in advocating for this change. I say the voice of the many because poll after poll has shown that the public is way ahead of Minnesota policymakers. The public is demanding this change and are widely in support of it. Recently, I spoke to a group of 100 students from Holy Angels, and I said, how many of you believe that if there's a teacher layoff, that we should do that using seniority as the measure? There was not one hand raised. And then I thought, well, maybe they're just being polite. So I said, okay, how many of you think, you know, sometimes kids don't want to talk. So then I said, how many of you think if there's a teacher layoff, performance should be the criteria? And every hand in that room went up. Let us lead and honor the teaching profession by placing our faith in educators' ability to keep our best teachers, and let us provide them with the financial and policy resources to maximize our students' chance for a lifetime of success. I believe we owe our students that. So finally, with regard to the amendment, I've heard from districts that in order for the first cycle of teacher evaluation to be complete before this policy is in effect, we needed to move the effective date. So that is in the amendment. In addition, I learned that the bill was not clear in terms of including probationary teachers in the performance first category, as their layoffs occur in a different section of law and timing period entitled Notice of Termination. So it really is a technical change just to make sure that the intention of the bill is clear. We included that Notice of Termination language within the original bill. Lastly, the right to appeal language was deleted so that there was no confusion. Tenured teachers have a right to appeal, but because we're making sure that probationary teachers are included, we did not want it to look like now probationary teachers have additional appeals rights, and so therefore it wasn't necessary to keep that provision within the bill. Before moving to our testifiers, I just would like to address some of the criticisms that I have heard. I have heard that we shouldn't focus on layoffs because they really don't happen very much anymore and that the problem has been overstated. In 2008 and 2009, there were 667 layoffs. 2009 and 10, 601. 2010, 11, 574. 2012 and 2013, 350. And these layoffs are the unrequested leave layoffs. They are not the pink slip type. So those numbers are understated. We hear, is this really fair when our students are bringing so many challenges into the classroom? Poverty, homelessness, not having enough food. All of these things are valid, members, and nobody is suggesting that a teacher is the one who has to bear the brunt of all these challenges. Yet I would assert that with these challenges, it's more important than ever to have the very best teacher in the classroom. I hear this will create an atmosphere and a culture of competition and limit collaboration. Well, I completely reject that notion because I believe in teachers. I believe that we are all meant to be mentors and to teach, that that's human nature, and that our teachers are in their jobs because of their passionate, passionate interest in making a difference for children, and that will continue. Some have said and quoted a company in my district, Cargill, as having moved away from performance evaluations. I spoke to the Human Affairs Director, Government Affairs Director, this morning to clarify, and in fact, that is not true. They do not rate their employees, but they certainly do evaluations, and in a layoff situation would use talent, skill, and ability, as well as strategic mission when making those determinations. So finally, in 2012, this legislation was passed and the governor vetoed it. The governor vetoed it because he said that we needed to have a strong teacher evaluation system in place before we act on this. Well, we have that teacher evaluation system in place, and most importantly, it was designed by teachers and the districts negotiated how to implement that teacher evaluation policy with their administration. So what this bill does is it does put the power back into the hands of the local districts and the teachers because it says use your tool, use your locally negotiated teacher evaluation tool to determine who are your best performers and make sure they stay in the classroom in the case of a layoff situation. Finally, the issue around will administrators abuse this and let go the most expensive teachers, and, you know, they better not. And what we've done in the bill is we've put a provision in there that says you may not use remuneration as the basis for that, and we really hope that that strong signal gets to the administration that if, in fact, that happens, then our teachers certainly have the right to appeal, and I'd be standing right there with them. Again, though, as somebody who used to manage large amounts of people, I can't imagine letting my highest paid, highly effective people go rather than those who weren't contributing to the organization.
Quorum's present. Senator Bonhoff moves the author's A2 amendment. All in favor indicate aye.
Aye.
Carried. We have Senate File 92 as amended. 97, excuse me. And we have about 17 minutes left.
Yep. I'm ready to, at this point, turn it over to my testifiers. I'm joined by a few people today. I know there's many more who will be testifying throughout the morning, but I have asked a few to come and sit with me today and share their thoughts. So I will begin with Don Samuels from the Minneapolis School Board.
Welcome.
Thank you. And thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Try that other mic.
Or
the other microphone should work, hopefully.
Yeah. Thank you for having me here. It must just be me.
I don't think so.
Okay. All right. No. I don't want to lose it. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you for having me and for
keep doing that.
For indulging my presentation. There goes my notes.
That's what happens.
You're very adept.
That's okay. But last night my wife was here testifying yesterday on education, and here I am today. It is no accident. 18 years ago, we moved into the Jordan neighborhood in Minneapolis, in North Minneapolis. She was a business consultant, and I had my own small design business. And we moved in out of a conscious. After conscious contemplation of what was happening in our African-American community and what could remedy it. And we felt that the flight of the black middle class was a major factor. Just people wanting a better life for themselves and their children, it's a natural flow, just as was the flight of the white middle class. Things just happen naturally in a free, capitalistic society. People take advantage, and things happen and work out in certain ways. But it's been disastrous for inner-city communities as integration and then the flight of the white middle class and the black middle class led to the concentration of poverty in communities like North Minneapolis, with all their attendant problems. And so we decided to reverse the brain drain in our own lives. The day we moved in, two houses down, another black family was moving out because their children had reached puberty and they felt that they couldn't raise them in North Minneapolis safely. And this is a constant drain. And there's certain flows like that, natural ebbs and flows that happen in communities like ours that keep things the way they are. And one of those is the flow of teachers. And it's nobody with bad intent. There's just a pull of good teachers, of highly effective teachers, to well-heeled communities. The parents demand it. My daughter goes to Anthony Middle School in Southwest Minneapolis. It's a well-heeled school. And she's a high-performing student. She has a cluster of high-performing friends. And when they're in a class with a less than effective teacher, all their parents hear about it. And then the principal hears about it. And in a very effective and efficient time, that teacher is gone. It might take a year or two, but that teacher is gone. On the other hand, in the community that I live, a highly effective teacher then is going to be called by that school and offered a job. Or that teacher is looking for a group of students who are more responsive to their instruction and naturally move to where the better students are. So the push and the pull of just the nature of freedom in a free society means that constantly resources, residential resources, teacher resources, police resources. We have the least African-American minority police in North Minneapolis than anywhere in the city. And I was on the city council, so I know that for a fact. And in fact, at the police academy, they discourage police from policing in the communities where they grow up. And so we have all of these features in our free and just society that naturally pull resources out of communities like North Minneapolis and into the well-off communities. And there's another thing happening here today. There are certain constraints upon members in this body to support this bill, not because the public doesn't want it, but because there are certain forces pulling on us at all times that keep things the way they are. And in fact, exacerbate the conditions that communities like mine have. It is not a mystery. And sure, as Senator Bonhoff said, there are family issues. Those two are natural outcomes from the way things are. And we must work on all of them. But certainly, the reason I am here today is because we believe that this is one of the things that we must work on. While we fix our families, while we get good policing that respects people, while we stem the flow of the black middle class so that children in the community have role models, while we do all those things internally, we need some help from the outside. On top of all of those disparities, the fact that we have, at any given time, 25% of the entire state's sex offenders in North Minneapolis. It's a natural flow, because when one comes in, there's no big community meeting to repel them. People are too overcome by all the challenges they face, so that we have to just can't go to another meeting. And so all these things are piling on. And here's another thing piling on, that we get disproportionately the least effective teachers and we're not able to keep them. I'll tell you the story of Leanne Stevens, an African-American young female teacher in Minneapolis who was fired because of she was last in. 2 years later, she was Teacher of the Year for the state of Minnesota. An African, that's what I'm talking. The natural flows, because of the mechanisms that are in place, are depleting the resources of communities like ours and putting them where resources already are. Can we stem this injustice? In all of our capacities, can we step up to the plate and do what we can? I'm doing what I can. I'm living in the hood. I joined the city council, and then I joined the school board. But then there are all these other things that I can't control. And I'm here as one who is really doing all I can to ask you, can you do all you can to make sure we don't lose our best teachers because they're young and younger or newer, that they're as enthusiastic as they are, as hardworking as they are, high capacity as they are? Nothing can keep them in our district because of the current laws. We need your help. We can't do it alone. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Samuels.
I'd like to ask Scott Hernquist to introduce the next testifier, and I would like to thank Mr. Samuels for his amazing leadership and service. So thank you.
Thank you. And Senator Bonhoeff, we have about 8 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Scott Kronquist with the Association of Metropolitan School Districts, and so I will be very brief, but did want to go on record as saying AMSD, one of our top priorities this session, was to advocate for legislation that would give school boards, school districts, greater ability to retain their most effective teachers. We think that is the important frame here. We would thank Senator Pratt and Senator Bonhoeff for bringing forward such legislation. Clearly, under the legislation, seniority can still be a major factor. In fact, will be, but it won't be the only factor, which is the case in the current state law. So I'm going to cut it short there, Mr. Chairman, because I'd much rather let Mr. Tim Alexander, Assistant Superintendent from Minnetonka, share his expertise.
Thank you. Welcome. And Senator Bonhoeff, I encourage your remaining testifiers to join you at the table just to expedite. Yep. Welcome.
So if Marika is here, or the parents that are coming, come to the table, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tim Alexander. I am Assistant Superintendent in Minnetonka. I also serve on the MASPA Board of Directors, and I'm currently the president of our national organization. I just want to share a few comments here this morning about Senate File 97. I really believe that Senate File 97 supports the concept of recognizing teacher effectiveness in making decisions about who stays and who goes when that type of issue presents itself. We do have the responsibility to our children to make sure that when these decisions are made, that we're making them on what is in the best interest and the education of our children. I believe the legislation will only impact a small percentage of our teachers. But even at that, we are talking about a significant number of students who will be impacted by these decisions. I currently have the pleasure of serving as the president of our national organization. In that capacity, I recently wrote an article entitled "Teachers Really Do Make a Difference." In that article, I talk about John Hattie's research on the most influential impacts on our child's education. The student themselves has the greatest impact on a child's education at about 50%. Second, though, is the quality of the teacher at 30%. There are some interesting data points provided by that study done at Harvard and Columbia that talk about the impact on a child's lifetime earnings and the impact on the quality of teaching has on that child's future. None of these decisions are easy, and I do not anticipate that these decisions will be easy in the future. I only hope that we will not shy away from something as important as impacting a child's future because it's easier not to make those difficult decisions. I believe we owe it to our children to create a system that allows for us to maintain highly effective teachers when faced with very challenging employment decisions. Our current system does not take into consideration teacher effectiveness when deciding who goes and who stays when we are faced with reductions in staff. A system that relies purely on last in, first out does not align with the philosophy that teacher effectiveness is a factor when educating our children. I believe Senate File 97 will provide an opportunity for us to work through a process at the local level and create a system that will recognize teacher effectiveness as a factor when making these difficult decisions. Teacher seniority will be a factor at the local level in making these decisions, but it should not be the only factor considered. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Denise Dietrich. For the record, I represent the Minnesota School Boards Association, and I want to thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony today on Senate File 97 and House File 2 as well. The issue of placing teachers on unrequested leave of absence is very important to school board members, as demonstrated by the 32 references to school board members in the bill. MSBA wants to be very clear. Senate File 97 is not about getting rid of teachers who are not performing. That is the role of the teacher development and evaluation system that we have in place currently. But this bill allows us to retain the best teachers when layoffs are required due to financial issues, reduction in pupils, or consolidations. And obviously, our first preference would be is that the ULA process would never be needed. One way to minimize that impact is to adequately fund education. But I'll go back to Senate File 97 now. We all know that school boards are responsible for the hiring and the painful job of letting teachers go when layoffs are required. When this happens, school board members need the flexibility to retain the excellent teachers that best fits the needs of the district, the school, and the students for today and in the future. As I prepared for today, I recalled just how painful this process is. I served as a school board member in the Anoka-Hennepin School District from 1998 to 2004. And during that time, we experienced severe budget cuts that resulted in reductions in staffing. And I will never forget when it came to the board meeting to make the motion to lay off all those teachers. It was a list of names that would be terminated only by seniority. There was a long silence. The silence was deafening. Nobody wanted to make the motion. We knew that these were the names of our newest hires. They were young, energetic educators, loved by their students in their community. As a district, we had just put time and money into their professional development only to let them go, and our hands were tied. The most unfortunate part of that experience is that list did not respond to the staffing needs of the district. It did not respond to the performance of our teachers. There was no assurance that we were retaining the right teacher in the right place for the right students. Locally elected school board members are ultimately the ones responsible and charged with making these staffing decisions, and they are held accountable for their outcomes. Board members should not be limited to one criteria in making these crucial hiring and letting go decisions. The public does not understand this type of decision making, and trying to justify it in the community is very difficult. This bill would allow the school board members to first evaluate their staffing needs before layoffs are needed, and then exercise their authority based on locally negotiated criteria, which may and should include seniority, because we all know experience matters in job performance. Finally, it allows the board to retain the right teacher for the right job. I hope that we can deliver on this request this legislative session. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. We have 2 minutes remaining for proponents.
Hi, my name is Tiffany Flynn Forslund. I'm extremely thankful to Senator Bonna for this bill. And I am in support as a mom of three children in the public school system. And I also am getting my teaching licensure. However, This impacted me and my family when my daughter was in fifth grade. She got an excellent teacher who excelled above all teachers that any three of my children had had. And he had moved to a new district, and because of LIFO or tenure, he was let go after getting top teacher, totally bringing his entire classroom to excelling levels of education, and he was laid off. And so it really impacted our family, and it didn't make any sense, and we really need to save great teachers for our kids.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Erin LeBoy. I am a parent of four children in Woodbury, Minnesota, and I'm also a teacher. I'm here today to speak in support of this bill to level the playing field for keeping great teachers in our school. Right now, our school in Woodbury, Valley Crossing Community School, is just laid off more than 10 teachers for next year, and it's all based on the seniority. The hardest part about that is that in our school specifically, seniority doesn't equate experience. Some of those teachers that were laid off were at the school in the early 90s when the school opened. They have 18 years teaching experience plus, but what happened is that they left for other opportunities and came back. And so now they're looking at layoffs or have been laid off for next year, even though they're very highly skilled and educated and well-trained teachers. And our school and our students are losing those teachers. And to parents like me, that just doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense that the most enthusiastic teachers are laid off. It doesn't make sense that it is not on their job performance, but only on when they signed a contract. So that's the reason that I am here today. As a parent, teacher layoffs are difficult no matter how you look at them. Teachers are the cornerstone of our school communities, and you never want to see any of them go, particularly if it's not by their choice. However, I feel confident in saying, and speaking for myself and most of my Valley Crossing community cohorts, that we'd be much more comfortable knowing that our teachers, if we had to have teachers leave our school, that it was based on their performance and not just based on when they signed their contract to begin teaching in our school. This legislation, in my opinion, is the strongest option to put our kids first in the decision-making and keep great teachers in our school, and that's what's important as a parent and as a community. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. LeBoy, and thank you, Senator Bonhoff. And as we agreed earlier, we're going to hear proponents, opponents, and then we'll have a chance for further discussion. And I can stay here throughout the evening if necessary, but there's people from out of town and others that we want to accommodate. So,
Mr. Chair, we used our 30 minutes to the minute, so I think we heeded your advice. I will say that Marika Pfefferkorn, I had planned to have her testify on behalf of the African American Leadership Forum. I do not think she's here, but I know if she does come, she could certainly join the other proponents.
Yes.
So in conclusion, members, I know you'll also be hearing Senator Pratt's bill, and many weren't here for my opening remarks, but I would just say that this policy is not a partisan policy. This policy is about coming together, finding a way to move Minnesota forward with regard to using every available tool to make sure the very best teacher is in our classrooms. This is not about getting rid of teachers. This is about having the very best teachers in front of our students. So I know this bill will just be laid over today, and I'm hopeful that by the end of session, we'll find a way to enact this policy. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Bonhoff. Senator Pratt, House File 2, and if you could invite your initial testifiers to join you.
Is there an author's amendment?
Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. Before I begin, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the H2 author's amendment.
I am looking for the amendment.
It's being distributed.
It's being distributed, and we'll act on that. I'd just like to have it in front of everyone.
Sure, and I can give you just a brief explanation.
Thank
Mr.
you.
Chair. The A2 author's amendment does two things. One, it changes the terms in the from lowest-ranked teacher to teachers with an improvement plan. That should be consistent with the other bills we've taken up. And then secondly, as we saw in the other body, there's a fiscal note attached to it, and so it just adds an appropriation section to make the bill, well, to at least recognize that.
And that is a description for everyone on the A2. All in favor indicate aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Adopted. We have House File 2 as amended before us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I'm happy to present House File 2, a bill that removes barriers in our current statutes that make it difficult to keep quality teachers in the classroom. Though the press and others characterize the bill as an anti-tenure bill, in truth, the objectives are much broader. House File 2 should get bipartisan support. This committee has already looked at many of the provisions, and so I'll be brief on them, but the first part of the bill is very similar to Senate File 559 that Senator Claussen presented last night. Just a couple of quick points on it. We removed the composite score from the qualifying ATT, only to look at the component scores. It reforms and improves the process for approving and hiring experienced teachers without a state licensure. It prohibits the Board of Teaching from issuing or renewing a license to anyone convicted of a heinous crime involving a child. And it requires the Board of Teaching to approve and reject a candidate who is applying by submitting a portfolio within 90 days, and also to advise them how to revise that portfolio going forward. Additionally, the bill updates the laws that allowed school districts and charters to hire community experts. House File 2 does not allow a community expert to replace or avoid hiring a licensed teacher. And it also has provisions that require school districts to notify parents when their child is being placed with a community expert. These changes simply make it easier for a school to hire a community expert and to fill a role where they would otherwise have difficulty finding a fully licensed teacher. We also see these options as being used primarily in the foreign language arena and where it's difficult to find fluent speakers. These two provisions address a need that I've heard that out-of-state and some metro districts are having a hard time finding teachers, especially in specialized areas. I'm also particularly supportive of the changes to streamline the out-of-state licensure for out-of-state educators. When my family moved to Minnesota, my mom started to apply for teaching jobs with 14 years of experience and had been teaching in four different states. What a shame if she would not have been allowed, if she had had to follow the process that we have in place today. She may have been frustrated and left the profession to find something else under these rules. Instead, she found a position in Shakopee and taught sixth grade for 25 years. She influenced the lives of hundreds of students and is often cited as their favorite teacher. And in spite of being elected to the Senate, many in Shakopee still call me Mrs. Pratt's son. The next provision is very similar to Senator Kent's bill that we'll be hearing, Senate File 1554, that provides that a student should not be placed with a teacher who's on a performance improvement plan for 2 years in a row. And finally, very similar to what Senator Bonhoff just talked about, the bill reforms the unrequested leave of absence statutes. It requires school districts and local teaching bargaining units to negotiate a plan when a district has to furlough staff due to discontinuous position, lack of students, financial limitations, or the merger of classes caused by consolidation of districts. The plan must consider and use the subject matter licensure fields, most recent evaluation outcomes, and the key, other locally determined criteria such as teacher seniority. The state and local districts have invested a lot of time, energy, and money in developing a teacher evaluation program that meet the needs of their communities. This is not about firing teachers. This is the use of additional criteria besides seniority in a collaborative effort that assures communities that they have the best teachers and that those teachers are retained if furloughs are needed. If he could distribute, a recent KSTP survey poll that shows 80% of Minnesotans say layoff decisions should be based on quality of teaching ability. You'll also see at your table a
picture. Yep. Oh, you should have got the color one.
Our staff went out and reviewed 301 of 329 school district contracts. And here's what they found. 100% of school districts utilize seniority as the primary factor when layoffs and decisions, staff reductions are necessary. 51 or 17% of independent school districts utilize administrative discretion as the primary tiebreaker if seniority is equal. But 13% of independent school districts list performance as a primary factor of being evaluated only when the primary tiebreaker between teachers is otherwise equal. Three districts use a coin flip as the final tiebreaker, and one draws lots. Members, this is not how we should be keeping teachers in the classroom when school boards are making very, very difficult decisions. Five of us at this table have sat at the school board table and made difficult decisions. I know that I wished I had been able to use more in my decision-making process when we had to make budget cuts and cut teachers. It's time that we modernize our statutes and that we use all the tools available and put this discussion into collective bargaining where it belongs. So, Mr. Chair, I'd like to start with Mr. Eli Kramer of Hiawatha Academy and then Ms. Valerie Doeslin.
Thank you. Welcome. Thank you very much, Senator Pratt. Thank you, members of the committee. It's an honor to be here today. For the record, my name is Eli Kramer. I am the executive director of Hiawatha Academies. We're a network of charter schools located in South Minneapolis. We serve a population of students, 98% of whom are students of color and 95% of whom qualify for free and reduced lunch. And we are honored to have been regularly on the Star Tribune beating the odds list for high performance in a setting like that. We have also won a federal grant through the Minnesota Department of Education, I think a first of its kind, to replicate our impact and grow to scale so that we can serve more students and close the opportunity gap in Minnesota. I wanted to share just a little bit about me briefly and how I got here in support of testifying on House File 2 along with Senator Pratt. I have been a Democrat my entire life. I took a semester off of college when then-Senator Dayton had just gotten elected to his Senate seat, and I went to be an intern, and the fact that it was paid, that was the best thing that happened to me in a while. I then, one of the most formative experiences in my own life politically was the day that the plane that Senator Wellstone was riding on crashed, and I decided to take some time off from college then and come home and campaign for Vice President Mondale in hopes that he would win that seat. And then I also worked for now Governor Dayton on his first campaign for the governorship in 2010 as a policy advisor in education. I did not know anything about education politics or education policy until I became a teacher in 2003. I started teaching in the District of New York City as a Teach for America Corps member, and what I saw in 2003 in the Bronx changed my life forever. There are schools in our big urban districts all across the country that are terrible places to be a kid, terrible places to be a teacher, that are just lacking in dignity that we wish all children in our city, our state, our country would have. And truly the most disheartening thing that happened after I taught for 6 years in New York City and then tried charters for the first time was when I started looking back to Minnesota and I started to learn that in Minnesota, in Minneapolis, the city that I grew up in, Minnesota, the state that we all love, the opportunity gaps in education, these challenges in our big urban districts are exactly the same as they are in the Bronx and New York City. We have some of, as you know, I'm sure, we have some of the biggest opportunity gaps for kids of color and kids from low-income backgrounds in the entire country. What I have learned over these last 12 years in this work have formed my opinions about what's at stake and how we can improve our schools, particularly for the kids who have been most historically disenfranchised, and I want to just share a little bit about what I've learned on this path. The first thing is that teaching is the most important thing. Teachers are the most important thing in great schools. if you want to have great teaching in every single classroom, of course, you need a great teacher in every single classroom. One of my most solemn jobs right now as the executive director of a network of three going on four schools is creating an environment that is great for being a teacher, a place where people, where teachers want to be and want to stay, and of course, a place where we can find the best teachers to join our classrooms. The current rules, as they exist in the state of Minnesota, put lots of barriers in the way of us choosing the best teachers to join our ranks and go and enter our classrooms. For one thing, the main barrier, the main first thing that must be true is whether a teacher currently has a traditional Minnesota teacher's license. And I want to tell you, from my experience, that is not a sufficient predictor of whether a teacher will be a great teacher in a classroom. It means something, but it is not sufficient. And also, as you know, what House File 2 does is to streamline out-of-state licensure and reciprocity fixes some rules that keep great people who may have a license from Wisconsin or New York but don't have graduate classes from Minnesota, keeps them from the classroom, which does not make sense to me. And finally, an element of House File 2, the community expert route, which I know you all are familiar with. We use the community expert route not because we want to, not because we have a desire to work outside of more traditional routes. It's because we want to find the best teacher for every single classroom. I just want to tell you about one story of a community expert teaching in our schools right now. His name's Matt Toppin. He had years of experience in Florida. He came back to Minnesota where he grew up, and he is literally one of our best teachers. In his first year of teaching in our classrooms, he more than reversed the entire achievement gap for a classroom of 7th grade math scholars. Our kids scored almost 80% proficient on the MCA, on par with the likes of kids in Minnetonka, sorry, Senator Bonoff, and Edina. Not on par with their demographically similar peers in Minneapolis. Way better than that. Some will argue, in closing, some will argue that streamlining out-of-state reciprocity or using community expert routes lower the overall bar for quality in our classrooms. And I'm here to tell you that for us, it's exactly the opposite. My most solemn duty to my kids and my families that I serve is to find the best teacher. Having a Minnesota license is not a perfect predictor of being a great teacher. A teacher with an out-of-state license might be the best teacher for a job. A teacher with a proven track record and a rich set of experience and a culturally similar background to the kids that we serve might be the best teacher for a job. And I ask for your help. Please help schools hire the best teachers for their kids.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Valerie Dozeland. I represent the Minnesota Association of School Administrators. And I'm here to speak to two provisions in House File 2. MASA believes that school districts should be able to consider teacher effectiveness when making layoff determinations rather than relying solely on seniority. MASA does not view this as a way to eliminate ineffective teachers. We have the teacher development and evaluation process in place to work with teaching staff to improve teaching instruction, and there are other provisions in statutes that school districts work to remove ineffective teachers. However, when making unrequested leave of absences, MASA believes that we school districts should be able to look at something other than seniority. We do not the current seniority process for unrequested leave of absences is not in the best interest of student learning. Schools around the state are working hard to provide effective education for our kids, and we need measures in place to help them keep the most effective teachers. I'll use one example. You heard from the Osseo School District a few weeks ago about the great results they are getting in closing the achievement gap and improving graduation rates. In order to do that, Osseo Area Schools has invested in many areas and have provided extensive teacher training and development of their teachers, especially in the areas of STEM, AP, IB, and their magnet schools. While Osseo is not making layoffs right now, they may have to in the future. And under the current process, some of these teachers would simply have to be let go because of their seniority. Yet they are getting great results for Osseo Area Schools. This simply just doesn't make sense. Just to reiterate in closing, MASA supports requiring a process as laid out in House File 2 and in Senate File 97 for all parties to come together and negotiate a different unrequested leave of absence process based on something other than seniority. And I just want to speak very briefly to the provision in the bill that is also in Senator Kent's bill regarding the student placement of students. We share the goals outlined by Senator Pratt. We do have some, and I've discussed this with him, and we do have some just like technical and some logistical challenges that we think the provisions in this bill may provide, especially for smaller school districts that might not have a lot of classrooms at the different grade spans. So I'll continue to have those conversations with Senator Pratt and with Senator Kent. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Mr. Aronson.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm Roger Aronson. I represent the Elementary and Secondary School Principals Association. We appreciate the opportunity here to give you some information on this bill and on the other bill that appears in front of you. First of all, I want to say that we are in very strong support of the teacher licensure provisions that are in this bill. And as Senator Pratt and Senator Claussen are both addressing that issue, this is a key issue for rural Minnesota principals. That we get staff into our classrooms and that we can use people, particularly from out-of-state licenses in our border cities, and we strongly support that. I want to make a comment about the unrequested leave provisions in this bill. School principals are in a very unique position in this. First of all, we're subject to the same provisions in the statute as the teachers are. If you go through the definitional provisions of the statute, principals are teachers for purposes of this bill, and we would be subject to the same types of layoff provisions that are being proposed here. We would negotiate new plans for the layoff of principals, much like as would happen with the teachers. We think that we can be successful in that, and I think a good lesson can be drawn from the, not negotiation, but the agreements on local evaluation plans. You charged us with the responsibility to develop local evaluation plans or have the default state model in recent legislation. We actually all, in all of our school districts, agreed on local evaluation plans. And I think that's good evidence that we can do this. I want to make one comment about evaluation themselves. That's what my clients want me to do here, to tell you a little bit about this. There's a little point in this, and as you make your decisions on this, I'm sure you'll have some discussion about it, but a common evaluation model creates four domains. I actually reviewed one of our more successful district evaluation programs yesterday, but where you have planning and preparation, classroom environment, instruction, and then professional responsibility. And then teachers are actually rated in those four areas: unsatisfactory, developing, proficient, or exemplary. This is a very common model that's adopted. Now, what we're going to have to do at the end of that is take that the subjective information and then somehow assign a value to it and inject it into the system. That's what you're asking us to do. I think we can do it, but it does take an awful lot of work to get there. And I want to say in conclusion, and I made a note about this, our teachers are very, very important to us, as are our superintendents and as are our school boards. One of the senior members of the education lobbying group used to say, Bob Meeks, some of my friends are for this and some of my friends are against this, and I'm with my friends. We actually do find ourselves in that particular position on this, Mr. Chair, and with all respect to the authors, if you pass this, we'll work it out. So thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome.
Please go ahead. Here.
Okay. Good morning. My name is Stacy Silvine. I'm the Executive Director of Human Resources for the Burnsville-Eagan Savage School District. I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today about House File Number 2. I appreciate the discussion about retaining effective teachers during staff reductions. As I'm sure you know by now, the research clearly demonstrates that a major impact on student growth is a highly effective teacher in the classroom. Unfortunately, under current practices of seniority, this is not always the case during staff reductions. In Burnsville, the contract defaults to the statute language and releases the least senior teachers in licensed areas. The school board has brought to the table the last two negotiation periods language to modify our current practices. Both times, the proposals were rejected. This is a growing concern for us because nearly 24% of our 750 teachers are probationary, and there is little that we will be able to do to protect from the lease some of our most effective teachers. In 2005, our district had nearly 11,000 students. Now we are at 9,300. During the past decade, we have had to reduce staff on a number of occasions. During the ULA process, it is not uncommon to receive pushback from parents, students, and community members when an effective teacher has to be released. Stating that the decision was made on seniority alone and not on teacher effectiveness leaves many puzzled and unsatisfied. We have good staff. Our teachers work hard and want the best for students. We have addressed ineffective teaching and seen improvement or personal choices to pursue other opportunities. What we haven't been able to do is protect those who are the most effective when restructuring is needed. I am in support of the spirit of the language and have two requests for this bill. That it requires a means to preserve our most effective teaching staff regardless of the date in which they were hired, and that it provides data protection for teachers that are placed on unrequested leave of absence. To the first point, I appreciate having multiple criteria, not just seniority, be agreed to locally. Current language appears to say that districts may have probationary teachers be a part of the local agreed upon criteria. I believe that the criteria must include probationary teachers. The locally defined criteria should recognize that probationary teachers are often experienced and extremely effective. While 24% of our teachers are considered probationary, only a quarter of them are first-year teachers. To the second point, I ask that language be included that protects the teacher's ULA status from data requests. There is a difference between a teacher who is released because they are grossly ineffective and a teacher that is placed on unrequested leave of absence. Teachers that are on ULA may not be as effective as teachers that are retained, but it should not be interpreted that the teachers are being disciplined. Often the concerns are limited to specific areas that may improve with efforts from the teacher. If possible, we want to work with the teacher on those targeted areas and hopefully bring them back if we have positions available. We do not want unwarranted claims made against these teachers. When we have to reduce staff again, I hope that the community will look and see that while the teacher numbers are fewer in our district, it is clear to everyone that the most effective team of teachers is still in place. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm not going to talk. I don't want to repeat my testimony from earlier in regards to the ULA piece, but I do want to speak just briefly in regards to the licensure component of House
please
File
please
2.
Please state your name for the record.
Tim Alexander. I'm the Assistant Superintendent in Minnetonka, also a member of the MASPA board and current NAEN president. I don't want to repeat that testimony, but what I do want to talk about a little bit on House File 2 is the language that speaks to simplifying the process for teacher licensure, in particular teachers licensed in other states. This is not a matter of lowering standards that we have in our state, but rather simplifying a process that is extremely complicated and quite often discouraging to individuals who are highly trained and have a proven record of success in the classroom. Minnesota is a very attractive relocation spot for highly trained professionals in many fields. And through that relocation process, we can often benefit from a spouse who has a proven record as a successful teacher. We need to have a system that recognizes success and allows those who meet our standards, even though those standards may have been met in another state, to find a much simpler path to become a teacher in the state of Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Radosovich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Sarah Radosovich with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, here to speak on four pieces of House File 2 quickly. First of all, on the layoff provisions, when districts face the difficult decision of laying off teachers, we think they should have the ability to consider what's best for students. That is, keeping the best possible teachers in the classroom. Let's not keep a system in place that is blind to quality. Both of the bills before you, Senate File 97 and House File 2, make sure that our teacher evaluation system, which is now fully functional, is part of the unrequested leave of absence process. The bill allows districts and teachers' unions to negotiate how much of the process is performance-driven and what other criteria, including tenure, and other locally negotiated criteria are included. A great report from MNCAN is being distributed to you right now, and this lays out some of the damaging and avoidable consequences of our current LIFO policy. For example, based on national data, 5 out of 6 teachers removed under LIFO would have remained in the classroom under an effectiveness-based system. In 2012 to 2013, in that school year, Minnesota had about 350 teacher layoffs. This means 291 folks were removed from our classroom who, if performance could have been considered, they would have been kept in front of our students. I'll move on for the sake of time to the other components of the bill I want to speak to in House File 2. Minnesota faces a teacher shortage. Our schools also seek a diverse workforce, as you've heard today and in other committee hearings. We should not be throwing up extra roadblocks to qualified teachers from out of state. We should make the process as clear and simple as possible for qualified individuals from out of state to get a Minnesota teaching license without compromising our standards. This bill, House File 2, helps us make progress towards that goal. Third, I want to speak to the community expert provision just very briefly. This allows school districts to fill hard-to-fill positions in world languages, language immersion, and the arts. We should give districts the freedom to fill these positions. There are public reporting requirements in place. There is a provision in the bill to require parent notification when community experts are in the classroom. And, of course, the requirement that districts first make all reasonable attempts to hire a licensed teacher. It's also important to note that the number of folks teaching under this designation is really quite small. It's 466 total individuals from the 2013-14 school year. Some of those are teaching part-time in multiple districts, so the actual number of community experts is only 406. And if you look at full-time equivalents, it's only 280. Finally, House File 2 includes a license requirement exemption for part-time vocational or career and tech ed teachers. We know that students need an introduction to a range of career options, and they need that introduction to happen in high school or earlier. That way they can learn what their interests are, maybe accrue some college credit, and move through to college and career with less debt and less costly redirection. Together, the community expert and tech ed provisions give students exposure to a broader range of academic content and career and technical options. This enriches student learning, and it helps kids find their way more affordably and more quickly to a career path. So for these reasons, the Chamber supports both House File 2 and Senate File 97. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Welcome.
Good morning, Chair and members. My name is Marika Pfefferkorn. I'm here on behalf of the African American Leadership Forum. I am an educator, and I've been around in the education field for the last 15 years. I've worked with districts both in the urban areas and rural. And I'm here to advocate on behalf of integrating performance measures into this piece of legislation. Right now, in my experience, being a coach and advocate in education, I frequently encounter teachers that are really excited about the profession, but hesitant to move forward, knowing that they could be struck out right after they receive their early tenure. And that has minimized not only a great pool of educators, but it's minimized teachers of color and the pipeline that we're trying to create here in Minnesota. The piece with the Teacher of Color pipeline, we are trying to grow our own and develop and cultivate a pool, but right now we don't have the numbers necessary to really diversify this workforce, and so it's necessary to have a Teacher of Color pipeline that can contribute and fill this gap until we've really fundamentally shifted how we are hiring and preparing our teachers. For me, I had a recent conversation about the financial hardships that some teachers experience when they are coming to Minnesota and applying for licensure here. And again, that is a drawn-out process that leads to some people deciding to go into other areas of work or are really frustrated with the process, or choose not to work in a formal capacity in education. The other piece is both in charter schools and in local public schools, which charters are also public, really thinking about filling the niche of community experts, because it's not about replacing people, it's about responding to the needs of students and what the needs are immediately in that classroom. And therefore, we really need to have that flexibility to allow that to really come to fruition. The African American Leadership Forum has produced a report on the five gaps in education. And a part of that is around teacher quality. And we're speaking about teacher quality in the sense of how are we responding to the immediate needs of our students, because this conversation at the end of the day is around our young people and providing them a very strong and good public education, which requires having a reflective experience, a relevant experience, and we need to be drawing in the individuals to make sure that we are providing that. I want to also mention that with the community experts, it has been demonstrated that, again, in earlier testifying, that the numbers of community experts are not that significant, but the role they play really is. And community experts are also another path to teacher licensure, where people can get their understanding and experience in before they commit to a full role. So there are multiple paths that we want to encourage for teachers to come into Minnesota, and through this legislation, we are hopeful that we will be able to start on that path. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Sellers.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Again, my name is Daniel Sellers, Executive Director of MNCAM, Statewide Education Policy Advocacy and Research Nonprofit, and I do have a handout that relates to this testimony. Testifying just last night on the importance of improving pathways to licensure for out-of-state teachers, and today wanted to share stories of two educators who have been impacted by the arbitrary and capricious manner in which licensure decisions have been made for talented educators from other states. I want to share the stories for three reasons. One, the stories are illustrative. They explain how confusing and nonsensical the process has been over the last few years in a way that few data or charts can. Two, the stories are representative. The unfortunate truth is that these two examples are not outliers, but instead represent the types of frustrations that dozens of qualified educators have faced when trying to get licensed to teach in Minnesota. And three, they are memorable. And that's important because my biggest hope is that 4 years from now we are not back here having the same conversation. I am hopeful that progress will be made on the issue this year. But I've been told in the past that the problem was solved, and simply put, that has not been the case. Legislative intent has not necessarily translated into administrative action to the point where judicial intervention became and becomes inevitable. I should note that I've changed the names of the individuals, but I would be happy to share their resumes and details privately with any legislator. There has been, at least in the past, fear of retribution from licensing bodies in Minnesota, which leaves some people feeling wary about sharing their names publicly. We'll call the first teacher Ms. Harris. She graduated with a degree in political science and Spanish. She received her JD from the University of Minnesota Law School. She clerked with the U.S. Court of Appeals. She completed master's coursework from Buffalo State University in New York on evaluating critical thinking skills at the upper elementary level. She is fully licensed to teach elementary education in California, passed all required MTLE exams on her first attempt, and came to Minnesota with 11 years of teaching experience in Oakland Unified School District and Shanghai, China. And that's the type of person that we're turning away. She was initially given a list of universities in Minnesota she could go to, and they would tell her what she needed to do in order to get licensed in Minnesota. This has been typical. The Board of Teaching, or MDE, defers to schools of education. She was told by Hamline University she would have to spend thousands of dollars and relearn what she'd already proven she could successfully do as a classroom leader, but she was so committed to teaching that she agreed to go this route and enrolled as an additional teacher licensure candidate. After completing several courses at Hamline, Ms. Harris officially applied for and was denied a teaching license by the Board of Teaching. It was at this point that she contacted MNCAN, We helped her hire a lawyer to represent her. She appealed the denial and over the course of several months filed a number of motions in the administrative law courts before the Minnesota Department of Education told her, and I'm not making this up, I've seen the letter, and I will share it with any of you, that if she dropped out of her Hamline University program, she could be considered under a newly established procedure and she would be granted a full-time license. Let me say that again. She was enrolled in a program that she had been told to contact and then was told if she dropped out of the program, she could now be granted a Minnesota teaching license. Our second teaching candidate is Ms. Anderson. She graduated from Middle Tennessee State University with a BA in English and a certification with licensure to teach 7th through 12th grade English. She completed a semester's of student teaching at both the middle and high school level. When she moved to Minnesota, she had 9 years of teaching experience. When she applied for a Minnesota license, she was initially told, just pass the MTLEs, take the human relations coursework, and you can get licensed. After she completed these steps, she reapplied and was then told to go speak with the university to find out what else she needed to do. She went to Concordia. She went to Hamline. They told her she needed more than 40 credits to get a license. Finally, she ended up at St. Mary's, who told her she had to complete 18 credit hours despite her 9 years of teaching experience. She just wanted to teach. She spent about $4,000, took more than a dozen credits, only to find out that St. Mary's would recommend her for licensure only if she spent an additional $1,000 and completed student teaching, something she had already done more than a decade ago in Tennessee. For her, it was the straw that broke the camel's back. As I said yesterday, in similar circumstances, she reached out to MinCAN, we put her in touch with a lawyer, and like that, she was granted a Minnesota license. So this is where we're left. Teachers having to hire lawyers to get licensed, to be told to speak to universities, which are advising them to take courses that they don't really need. In fact, in the case of Ms. Anderson, in the end, the Board of Teaching sent her a letter apologizing for the confusion and saying that she had been incorrectly advised by St. Mary's University, even though she had been told to go speak to them in the first place. It's simply not true that this problem has been fixed, but you have an opportunity to fix it by passing House File 2 today, and I encourage you to support the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome.
Hi, thank you, Mr. Chair and Senators. My name is Lynnell Michelson. I live in Minneapolis, and I'm here as a parent. All three of my sons attended Minneapolis Public Schools from kindergarten through graduation, so I spent nearly 20 years as a parent in that system. Now, as a longtime parent, I know student enrollments go up and they go down. Layoffs happen. My three sons were in school during the last infamous wave of layoffs in Minneapolis. Between 2001 and 2011, Minneapolis lost 27% of its enrollment and nearly 1,000 teaching positions. Almost all these layoffs were done by strict seniority. Great teachers were forced out. Dismal teachers were retained. Teachers of color were the last to be hired. They were shipped out too. During that period, we lost, in terms of raw numbers, over half our teachers of color. And this is in a district where almost 70% of our kids are kids of color and 87% of our classroom teachers are white. It was horrible, and it made me an activist on this issue because I don't think this policy serves our kids or the taxpayers or the teaching profession or the union itself. Now, those of us who support these kind of bills, I'm a Democrat, are often told that we're anti-labor, but I'm telling you, as someone who has who organized on behalf of a union and open shop, I think this policy is a disaster for labor as well because young teachers get the message very early on that their work is not valued, only their date of hire. And I think in the long term, it is really, really bad for labor. Now, I'm a long-time DFLer. I'm a former union member, and I just think this is not the way to go. But wait, it gets worse. The public knows this is a bad policy. The polling shows anywhere between 80 and 90% of the voters want layoffs to be based on more than the date of hire. Now, think about this. What other issue can you name that has 80 to 90% support across party lines? I know this bill is considered controversial and partisan here in the Capitol, but this is really the only place where that's true. Outside of this island, the majority of the public supports this bill because it's common sense. I just have to say, we talk about the noble mission of public schools and the ability of government to lift people up when they need it. So if we're going to talk about this stuff, I think we need to walk our talk. And I have to say, I think it's immoral to deliberately and knowingly and as a matter of state policy get rid of a great teacher and put 25 kids in a classroom for a year with an uninspiring, mediocre one. And that is what, all based on the date of hire. I don't know how you can justify this if you love public schools and to the taxpayers, and I don't know how you justify it from a pro-labor position. None of you would want this to happen to your own children or your grandchildren. This bill is common sense. It's the moral and smart thing to do, and I urge you to support it. Thank you.
Thank you.
And, Mr. Chair, we have one more on the list, Bruce Corey. Is Mr. Corey here? Okay. Well, Mr. Chair, you know, that's my list, and just in closing, I want to thank Senator Housley for co-authoring the bill with me here in the Senate and my colleagues on in the other body. I think what we've heard, Ms. Mickelson, I think, said it very well. This is not a Republican-Democrat issue. This is a common sense issue that we need to take on. We've got a lot of programs. We've got a lot of policies that we've put in place. I'm pleased that the DFL senators in this body have joined the Republicans in challenging the commissioner and the governor on his education finance bill, because that would cause cuts and higher class sizes in schools. And what we're proposing is not in a vacuum. We have been out there saying our schools need stable, reliable, and adequate funding to do their job, and we shouldn't be talking about teacher layoffs. But there'll be another great recession down the line. There'll be school consolidations, and we're going to need to address this at some time. And what better time to do it if we can walk out of here with a good finance bill, to do it when we're not in crisis, to do it when we can be thoughtful, and to do it at a time when our teacher evaluation system is fully implemented. So, members, I hope you'll support House File 2. And, Mr. Chair, I don't know what the motion is going to be now that I've added an appropriation, but I'll leave that up to you.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Pratt. And we're going to continue to hear testimony now. And we have 9 or 10 people listed. I believe Josh Davis is first. I've added Rebecca Gagnon. After Aaron Doan, but if people, as they are listed on the list, could approach the table so we can move this along. And following those presentations, we'll open it up for any questions, comments. And keeping in mind that it's the debate amongst us will be next week, that we can ask questions, but when we roll out the bill, there'll be other opportunities for us to exchange our points of view. Right now, we want to listen, question. So, welcome to the committee, and for each of the testifiers, again, please state your name and whom you're representing, if you are representing someone in addition to yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Josh Davis. I'm just going to find the play button here, and then I can ignore this. There it is. All right. So my name is Josh Davis. I am the director of research and lead professor for an organization called the NeuroLeadership Institute. We're based in New York City. It's a think tank with offices globally. I also live in New York City, so please forgive that lapse in judgment here. But as the director of research, I oversee strategy for identifying the challenges in organizations, and those would be in the corporate sector as well as government sector, that people need to address, and then guiding our research team in terms of how we're going to find what principles we can act on from neuroscience and psychology research to bring to bear. There is a practice area that we've been working on for probably about 3 years now, in response to a growing trend in particular in the corporate world, about what to do about performance management, and in particular the ratings and labels that are quite analogous here. So I'd just like to say I am thrilled to hear that Minnesota is considering doing away with something like last in, first out, and thinking about ways to retain teachers. I actually was a teacher. I taught physics and math in a Brooklyn last chance public high school. Absolutely loved it. And to be honest, I didn't want to try to find a different kind of school or go to the suburbs or anything like that. I love my kids and the challenges and you know the potential for growth that we had. For me, I left because you know you couldn't make a living doing that in New York at the time. So nonetheless, thrilled to hear that Minnesota is considering this. What I've been brought in by Education Minnesota to talk about is what happens when you go to a system of ratings or a system of labels, where you're giving everyone a single label or rating that's going to then be used as their evaluation measure. Psychologically, what happens there? Also, just briefly, a little bit more about who I am, my background, bachelor's from Brown University in mechanical engineering. I worked in that field for a few years, and then a PhD from Columbia University. After that, I was on the faculty at Barnard College for about 5 years in the psychology department. And yeah, I think that basically covers who I am. So, you know, just first, like to say very briefly a few more things about who we are so you know where this information comes from. So we're, our aim at the Institute is transforming leadership through neuroscience. We focus particularly on performance, diversity, and learning. This is in our performance practice. And the kinds of things that we do will be research briefings, thinking partnerships, which is more commonly called consulting, and then helping to roll things out across an organization, digital learning solutions. So it's also, there's the thinking, the think tank aspect, but also very much the commercial aspect. So just to let you know where this comes from. So the content here on the idea of performance ratings and labels, clearly we have a point of view. There's an article that I believe has been distributed that I was one of the authors on called Kill Your Performance Ratings, right? So I think you can see where I'm likely to head with this. But what I'd like to do is, rather than telling you that that has to be the way forward, to share with you the thinking behind it and the science and allow you to more effectively come to your own conclusions on that. So first of all, there are a few really counterintuitive issues when we're talking about performance labels or performance ratings. I think we tend to think, quite rationally, it's not that there's anything wrong with us for thinking this, we tend to think that rating people or giving them the label is going to accomplish these things, going to create fairness. We'll now have a single metric that we can look at everyone on this metric and we can say, okay, this is where they stand relative to one another, right? That it's going to help people compete, lead to healthy competition. You know, I don't want you to best me, so I'm going to work harder. Provides quality feedback. Right, that lets people know where they stand, and is going to motivate better performance. The issue is that those would be quite effective if what we were trying to motivate was better widgets. It's very logical. It just doesn't work with how brains work, though, is the problem. And so I'd like to go into some of why, but the fact that it doesn't seem to work. Now, this is actually a very well-tested hypothesis. Over the last... since the 1970s, essentially, when Lee Iacocca was really the one who brought this to the corporate world.
Excuse me, Dr. Davis, you mentioned the article. I don't believe we have it.
Oh, okay.
So
I'll make sure to share that.
Distributed soon. Thank you. Please
Thank
proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll make sure to share that as well as other articles that I'll mention at the end. And there's plenty of materials that I'd like to make available. Also, the slide deck in a PDF form or printout. I'd be happy to share that with everyone afterwards as well. So this is a well-tested hypothesis now in industry. What happens if we give people these rankings? And originally, one of the motivations was there were bloated companies, and they wanted to be able to have a quick way to get rid of the bottom few. So it was, you know, let's just get some rankings, and that way we'll have some way of justifying it. Those systems were then used to try to accomplish all of the various things that I was mentioning on the previous slide. So here we are, 40 years or so later, and we're seeing these kinds of results. So from Scullin et al., under 25% of performance ratings actually correlate to performance. Now, performance can be measured differently and will be measured differently in every organization. I heard a number of people up here in the previous testimonies saying things like, they know who the best teachers are. Obviously, there are ways to know who the best teachers are. And they know who the worst teachers are, right? So it's not that we can't figure these things out. It's a question of how do we figure it out? how do we evaluate? And that's one of the things that, you know, there today we have more data than ever. You know, in this era when we can collect data of all kinds, we have a number of things that we can use. It's the idea of reverting to a single rating when we have so many alternatives for the first time is especially troubling. We see data from some of the large industry research bodies. Two-thirds of top-rated performers, so when you do have, let's say, a ranking system, the people getting the top rating are actually not, if you look at metrics that matter to companies, in this particular case, it was who's contributing to the enterprise overall in terms of bottom line and in terms of collaboration, they weren't the top performers. Another piece is that when you start tying this, and I know this hasn't been talked about particularly in these testimonies about pay, but when you start using this to justify pay decisions, which is at least indirectly relevant here when we're talking about keeping people, 75% of people don't think it's fair anyway, regardless of what you do, even when you have metrics that show that they're paid above market, right? So this doesn't help with that. Now, this is where it really gets troublesome, though, is in this fourth bullet point. I think this is the one that really hammers, like, brings home the biggest point. When people receive a label like this, which necessarily is generalized, necessarily, because it's a single label, is not addressing all of their hard work over the year, is not addressing whether they happen to be being put up against a series of, you know, maybe everyone in this cohort is fantastic, or maybe everyone in this cohort is terrible, right? There is patent unfairness to it. And so whenever people are negatively surprised, it sticks with them. When you have the positive bump, you know, you get right at the top, you're like, okay, good, I worked hard, I thought I was good, great. Makes you feel good for a couple of weeks, and then the motivation bump goes away. When you get the negative motivation, though, feeling like you've been recognized unfairly, people hold on to that. It leads people to become disengaged, to want to leave an organization, to look for other ways out. Now, that's in the organizational space, you know, it wouldn't necessarily translate for teaching. What this study done at Dell was finding was that close to half the firm. So they're taking this firm of people who have been highly selected, excellent at their jobs, except for maybe a handful who they'd like to get rid of, and half of those people, they're now leaving them for a full year feeling demotivated as a result of this. And then there's Sherm's work, this is one of the big HR organizations, showing that as they look across performance systems that have been of this nature over the last 40 years, because most of them have been of this nature, that most of the organizations who run them would say that they actually are a failure. 90% are saying it is not accomplishing what they want. So it suggests a different direction. So here I'd like to share now some of the three core research ideas, neuroscience research ideas that are really driving how we explain why things haven't been working and what organizations are now doing instead. And perhaps there will be some analogies here that you think will be relevant. So the first has to do with the paramount importance when we want to help somebody lift their performance of minimizing threat. Human beings have, well, actually, I'm going to say that for a moment. Just give you the outline first. The second is something called a growth mindset. I don't know how many people in the room are familiar with Dr. Carol Dweck's work, a wonderful book called Mindset. I'll share more about that. And the third is the research indicating not only the value of facilitating insight, but actually that we can, that there are systematic steps leading up to an insight. They seem random and magical when they happen, but it actually is no coincidence that they happen in the shower. So often. So first of all, this piece about threat. When someone is in a threat state or experiencing something potentially threatening, and I'll say why this slide is up in a moment, there are systems in the brain that are highly active that are more easily activated than the systems that pertain to reward. We are designed to very quickly pick up on a potential threat in the environment, even if it's imagined, and react quickly. We have the ability to have parts of our brains activated before we can become conscious in 200 milliseconds that have hardwired links to change our hormonal responses, our behavioral responses, our neuro neurological reactions to get us moving very quickly, to change our emotions as a result, to change our behaviors, right? So we're hardwired to be recognizing these things and reacting quickly. Now, one piece that may be familiar, you know, when you think about fight or flight, or things that you've heard about, you know, when you look at other animals, what is often new to people is how, for human beings, some of the strongest triggers are the social triggers. And when you look across species, and you look at the size of the prefrontal cortex, it's the part of the brain right up in front, the part that's most different in human beings than in other animals. What you see is that the size of the prefrontal cortex is proportional to the size of the social network. We are exquisitely attuned to where we stand within a social network. Status is tremendously important. Status, not just meaning socioeconomic status, but who's better or worse on any dimension. Right? It's something that we can't not pay attention to. It's something that motivates us day in and day out. You'll see on the slide I've made away and threat larger in font size than towards and reward. When there's any kind of a threat to our status, it takes over these threat systems. It's very hard for us to concentrate. We have a surge of neurochemicals, in particular norepinephrine, that will go to the prefrontal cortex and cause over-arousal, making it very difficult to focus, very difficult to think clearly, harder to be creative. It's precisely the wrong kind of mental state to be in when you're trying to do great knowledge work such as teaching, right? So these kinds of status threats we are especially attuned to, and something like feeling like you've been, you know, negatively surprised by a rating or a label is a status threat that lingers, is one that just keeps on gnawing at you every day, right? And I think probably many people in the room have had the experience of having that thing that you felt like you weren't treated right, and you feel like, you know, it kind of knocked you down a rung, and it just keeps irking you. We're designed for that to keep irking us because we need to figure out where we fit within a social network. That's what brains are for. Human beings can't survive for the first 10 years of their life without having that very explicit understanding of where they fit within a social network. We have to rely on other people to take care of us. The other things that research shows seem to really drive these kinds of social motivators, certainty about what we're going to be able to do in our lives, you know, certainty about whether we're going to be able to take care of ourselves and our families. People can't think clearly when they don't have certainty about that. Autonomy, will we be able to have control over the decisions that we make? Will we be able to have control over whether how we teach our classes, things like that? Now, relatedness, this one has to do with whether we see ourselves as part of the group or not. And this is some of my favorite research from neuroscience that shows that it's sort of fun ways of making people feel rejected while their brains are being scanned. But what happens is that the brain areas that are active when a person is feeling rejected turn out to be precisely the same brain areas that are active when a person is experiencing physical pain. Now, we can tell the difference between social rejection and physical pain, of course, so there are some differences. But in important ways to the brain, it's the same. And you wouldn't expect somebody to perform well when you've just hit them in the leg with a 2x4 and they're smarting in pain, right? But we do expect them to perform well when we tell them, you know, we give them that harsh feedback and we tell them, you know, you really messed up here. You know, I won't use the language that's often used in a corporate space. On the flip side, when we experience the reward of social inclusion, we see activity in the same brain regions as we would for reward of other kinds. So this is core. It's sort of fundamental to who we are. We can't really avoid this. Understanding this, I think it becomes critical to take this much more seriously. This idea of minimizing threat when we want to actually take the people that are good and help them lift their performance. And we want to stop making it hard for ourselves by creating these sort of lasting threat states. And the final one, and this one I think is particularly relevant to the issue of ratings and labels, is fairness. when there is an experience of unfairness, there's activity in parts of the brain associated with disgust, there's activity in parts of the brain associated with pain. We see similar kinds of reactions there, right? Fairness has two components. There's equity, equal distribution, but there's also process fairness. And when people experience, and the second one is the one that's more important to people. When people have a sense that they are being, that there is a process that they can trust, they're often actually comfortable accepting inequity. And the most important piece in making a process seem fair is that they had a voice, that they had a chance to be heard and really felt like they were heard. And now, so I hear some of the discussion going to issues of layoffs and things like that. When there is an opportunity for a conversation where a person can have a voice, that seems to be more relevant than almost anything else. So also when we're talking about retention, of course. So the second piece, and also, by the way, you know, I'm typically comfortable with people asking questions at any point, so please feel free to. The second scientific principle on which a lot of this is based is what's known as a fixed mindset versus a growth mindset. Now, am I right that it's probably the case that some people in the room believe that intelligence is something you're either born with or not? Right? And other people in the room probably think that some people are just caring and other people aren't caring. And other people in the room think that some people are funny and other people aren't funny. Right? Whenever we think that a person is just like that, that's a fixed mindset. And when we think it can change, that's a growth mindset. Now, one of the surprising findings, which has been found probably 300 or so times in different ways, is that when we believe that we can change, we do. And a lot of this work, especially Dr. Carol Dweck's work, has actually been done with students and teachers in the classroom, showing that arbitrarily assigning, let's say, the teachers to have a belief that students can change their intelligence or not leads the students then to have better grades at the end of the year. Also, taking students that are at the beginning of the year equally distributed, you know, in terms of grades, if they have the belief that they can change, right? So what's happening, though, when we get to ratings is that we're reinforcing a fixed mindset. So some of the things that happen here is just to point to the slide to help you more richly understand the idea of this fixed and growth mindset. When we believe, for example, that intelligence is fixed or some other trait is fixed, approaching a challenge then would be a terrible idea because it's just an opportunity to fail if you have a fixed mindset. From a growth mindset, it's an opportunity to grow and change. Persistence. If you have a fixed mindset, then persisting on something would only be an indicator that you weren't good at it in the first place. When you have a growth mindset, persistence, of course, makes natural sense. And by the way, we all have fixed and growth mindsets to some degree about different traits, and we all can change them from time to time. That's one of the things that's nice about this, how malleable it is. Effort. Effort is fruitless because, of course, again, it's an opportunity to learn that you don't have what it takes if you have a fixed mindset. It is the path to mastery, the exact opposite with a growth mindset. The result of feedback. Feedback tells you where you stand. So either if you are getting feedback that things are great, then doing anything else means that you could lose what you've got. We call that a status cliff. You could fall off the status cliff. Feedback is something that you can use to learn, however, with a growth mindset. And, of course, negative feedback would shut you down because why would you work hard if you have a fixed mindset and you're told you're no good? Social comparison. So oftentimes we hold up people and say, so-and-so is doing great. We want to give you this example of someone who's really succeeding. Well, if there's also a fixed mindset being communicated, well, that means, okay, now I feel even worse. This person is great and I can't get there, right? But it's a model for somebody with a growth mindset. And we've probably all had experiences sometimes where we've done one and sometimes where we've done the other. So again, this idea that it's malleable. And then finally, what are we motivated by? With a fixed mindset, we're motivated by praise. In particular, praise about, oh, you're so good, you're so smart, right? Those kinds of things, approval. With a growth mindset, much more motivated by mastery. Now here's where I think it gets particularly interesting. It's things as simple as this that can shift around a mindset. So this was work that was done with students, giving them praise. Good job, you must be talented at this. Right? That reinforces, that primes a fixed mindset. Versus, good job, you really applied yourself here. And that reinforces a growth mindset. Now, it's not that we just want to reward effort and we don't want to reward performance. It's that if you reward effort, you get better performance. And now this can be done more extensively as well, of course, than just in the way you do the feedback, specific feedback or specific types of praise. But what's happening with these performance labels and these performance ratings is that it reinforces in a very strong way a fixed mindset. This is where you are, and you're stuck there for a year. And from what I understand, in the particular case of this bill, it would be stuck there for 3 years. Right? This is who you are. You know, people are at this level. There's nothing you can do about it. Right? And so it's very hard to work against that when you have such a strong prime out there, when you're showing people with things that pertain to certainty around their livelihood that there is this fixed mindset about their abilities. That's going to be a lot to work against. So this is just, in case you were thinking, well, if we can get everyone to have a growth mindset, then we could give them these performance ratings and labels and they could still use it more effectively. This is actually the title of an article. Study finds that basically every single person hates performance reviews. What the article was going into, though, was that in research looking at people with a growth mindset and a fixed mindset, looking at how they're taking these performance ratings and how they're using them, that it's demotivating everyone. It's just that the people with the growth mindset are able to get past it a little bit better. So it's still not, yes, they can work with it better, but why make it hard for everyone?
Excuse me, Dr. Davis, yes. Could I respectfully ask if you could sum up in the next 3 or 4 minutes?
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. So one final point to make is about the value of insight. And I'll just say this. This is once we start going into what would you do instead. And that what a number of companies are doing is, and I do mean quite a number, and these are major organizations. There's, I think, 30 on this slide, or 35 on this slide, of all different kinds, are doing is exploring how can we improve performance for those people that we know we want to retain. And it comes down to conversations that lead to insight. And now that we know more about the science of insight, we can actually help to train people up to coach one another, essentially, to do that kind of peer work that can happen. And these organizations, I think one of the previous testimonies mentioned that one of these organizations still has ways of evaluating people. Absolutely. It's very important to have ways of evaluating people. And so, I guess as I was saying earlier, you know who the good teachers are and you know who the bad teachers are. There are many ways. We still want to use information as we're talking to people. But when we store a label somewhere and people know that that label is being used to determine their livelihood, then we've just erased all of the potential to really be able to have these growth conversations. One final point I'll make is, I don't need to put a slide up for that. One final point I'll make is that there's just some data that the majority of organizations are now considering this change. One final point I'll make is that there is an important distinction between the aim to figure out how are we going to handle the small number of people that need to go, especially in the case when we're being forced to do layoffs, but even in other cases, and the bulk of people who we really do want to retain and work with. Those are very separate kinds of things. And because of the challenges that ratings and labels provide for the bulk of people, the 95%, 99%, I don't know what it is, who we want to retain and grow and work with, it's important to avoid, and this is what many of these organizations are doing now, avoiding making it difficult to work with those people with the ratings and labels once they've identified someone who does need to go, then they begin a totally separate process, which is very well documented, and where they can start having labels of whatever they need to, that kind. I've put up a list here also of further resources that I'd be happy to share with anyone. I've got my email address up there, and also through Education Minnesota can share out these documents with anyone in the room as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Davis, and welcome again to Minnesota. Okay, and we'll have a chance at about 10:30 or so for some Q&A, but first we're going to hear from the testifiers that have signed up. I have Kyle Swanson, Kate Schmidt, Jess Anna Glover, Jody Olson, Cynthia Christ, Alex Hasselton, Derek Olson, Aaron Doan, and Rebecca Gagnon. So if everyone could gather around as we move ahead. Yes, and to each of you, please state your name for the record.
Hello. Thank you for having me. My name is Kyle Swenson, and I'm a technology education teacher and a cabinet maker. I've been teaching for 7 years, most currently at Wayzata High School. I've been working in the woodworking industry for almost 13 years now, and have owned my own cabinet shop for the last 7. I am here to address concerns that I and other career and technical educators have with Section 10 of House File 2 on page 14 of the bill. As I and others read this bill, it would allow vocational and technical education to be provided in our public schools by individuals who do not have Minnesota teaching licenses. I believe this would dramatically lower the standard for our vocational programs in our public schools and negatively affect the quality of education we provide to our students. I would first like to identify this specific problem. We have a shortage of technology education teachers. This problem exists for several reasons, and I have come today with a few solutions that I and my colleagues have come up with to help solve the problem. First, we want to say that lowering or removing the standard of having a teacher's license is not a solution to the problem. If there were a shortage of pilots, would we lower the standard to obtain a pilot's license? Would we tell mechanics that you know how the plane works, you can fly them? I wouldn't want to be a passenger on that airplane. I will ask you to look at what I believe are 3 issues and their solutions which prevent many from going into teaching technology education. Problem number 1 is compensation. No teacher goes into teaching for the money. But when we compare salaries from skilled trades and those of teachers, more and more people are choosing not to teach. Here are some examples of what local tradespeople can expect to earn after earning their journeyman certificate, usually after five to six years of working. A journeyman pipe fitter will make about $72,000 a year. A journeyman electrician, also $72,000 a year. A journeyman plumber, $65,000 a year. In the Wayzata School District where I work, a fifth-year teacher makes $43,000, plus the fact that the teacher has a significantly higher education cost. The solution, I'm not suggesting that technology education teachers make more money, but I am suggesting that we could have some student loan forgiveness for technology education teachers who stay in the profession for at least 5 years. This could include current teachers to encourage them to stay in the profession. Problem number 2 has 2 parts of it. Number 1 is the skills gap that I'm sure you're all aware of, and the second is due to budget cuts in the last several years. There's very, very few teachers teaching technology education programs. Their programs have been eliminated. Right now, there are 2.5 to 3 million unfilled skilled trade positions nationwide. As a result of that, many technology education teachers are getting job offers to enter industry. I've had 2 in the last 6 months. Technology education programs have been cut way back in recent years, so they only service a fraction of the students in schools. Therefore, students don't get exposed to the skilled trades or get to see what a technology education teacher actually does. If they never see a technology education teacher, why would they pursue it as a career? The solutions for these 2 problems can be fixed with 1. Currently, to graduate from high school, all of Minnesota students need to take some form of art credit. If we expand that requirement to include the possibility of taking a technology education credit, we could fix those 2 problems. 1, to start to put a dent in the skills gap by getting more students interested in skilled trades. Also, with more exposure for students to see what a technology education teacher does, to see if they want to give it a go as a career, especially if they know that some student loans may be forgiven. Problem number 3 is the access to technology education teacher universities. Right now, to become a licensed tech ed teacher, you need to travel outside the metro area. The most popular programs are UW-Stout, St. Cloud State, and Bemidji State. If you are a working professional who wants to change careers, it's a huge financial burden to quit work and go to college full-time for the years you need to complete a degree. The solution there would be offering some night or online classes for non-traditional students to continue to be able to provide for their families while they're in school and become licensed. We need a metro university to offer a technology education as a field of study. The idea that someone with technical knowledge in a field like construction could come into a school and be an effective teacher is a bit misguided. As I said earlier, I've got experience both in the skilled trades and in education, and the people that I've worked with in skilled trades are wonderful people, but would not be very successful. Not all, some of them may be, but very few of them would be successful stepping straight into a classroom from a job site. It's not my subject matter that makes me alone that makes me an effective teacher. To be honest, the subject matter is the easiest part of teaching. Without my teacher training courses, I would not know how to prepare lessons, set up demonstrations, manage a classroom, or deliver curriculum in a way that is accessible to the different learning needs of my students. I'm reminded of a student who we will call Anas that I had earlier this year. This is Anas's third year at Wayzata High School. He came from Syria as a freshman. His parents decided to have him move to Minnesota after Anas's best friend shot dead by a sniper as he was talking with Anas. I had to lean on the knowledge I gained in my psychology classes and my teacher training program to help Anas be successful. Part of my teaching position, about one-third, is funded through a federal Perkins funding. The Perkins funding also pays for thousands of dollars in equipment in the lab in which I teach. In order to access the Carl Perkins Fund, a teacher must have a CTE license, or Career in Tech Ed license. In order to obtain that CTE license, you need to have a bachelor's degree, be a licensed teacher, and demonstrate competency in the area of your CTE license through a portfolio that is reviewed by the University of Minnesota or other qualified school. If I did not hold a teaching license from the state of Minnesota, I would not be able to access these funds critical to the success of many secondary technical education programs. Currently, if a district cannot find a licensed instructor to fill a given position, there is already a process in place for them to receive permission from the Board of Teaching to hire an unlicensed community expert. House File 2 would change that. Eliminating the Board of Teaching approval requirement would lower the standards for my field and is not necessary to address the shortage of licensed teachers. As we discussed, there are more creative ways to solve this problem. Some of them, like expanding the required art credit to also include technology education, are completely free, and everybody can get on board with that. In conclusion, our students deserve teachers who not only have a deep content knowledge, but also the ability to convey that knowledge to students effectively. I am asking you not to exempt K-12 vocational education programs from meeting the teacher licensure requirements as proposed in this bill, and would not allow districts to hire community experts without Board of Teaching approval. Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome. Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Kate Schmidt. I'm an elementary school teacher presently on leave from the Rosemont-Apple Valley-Eagan School District to serve as president of Dakota County United Educators. This is my 25th year in education and my 17th year as a negotiator. I'm here to testify in opposition to mandates that require the creation and inclusion of teacher performance ratings in layoff language and collective bargaining contracts. I oppose this mandate because it undermines local control and collective bargaining rights. Currently, Minnesota law gives local school boards and their teachers' unions the flexibility to negotiate any system for layoffs. The bill mandates performance rankings be included and does not allow local school boards and their exclusive representative to negotiate what they feel is best, most effective for their situation. Dakota County United Educators and District 196 have worked together to create processes and procedures for voluntary transfers, involuntary transfers, unrequested leaves of absence, and layoffs. For the most part, we do use the default system in statute, which lays off teachers according to seniority and licensure area. We choose to do this because, despite our best collective efforts, we have been unable to come up with a better system. However, we have crafted local solutions to specific problems, including contract language that values specialized training over seniority. Creating mandates that each local must include teacher evaluation in their collective bargaining agreements dismisses the working relationships that teachers have with their districts and does not consider the needs of the local communities. D196 DQ and District 196 have invested a significant amount of time in developing our teacher development and evaluation plan, as well as our QCOMP plan. They both work from a growth mindset. Our plan does not include ranking our teachers based on their summative evaluation. It was a conscious choice we made together. Rewriting this plan to provide for high-stakes rankings would waste time and taxpayer money that could be better spent on things that will improve educational outcomes for children. I'm also concerned about this mandate because without past regular evaluations of all teachers, it's virtually impossible to write write fair performance considerations into layoff language. Most of the state is in its first year of implementing their teacher development and evaluation plans. In my district, we are just starting to train our administrators on how to evaluate. Our plan is definitely not fully functional. According to our plan, only a third of our non-probationary teachers will have a summative evaluation each year. How do we write language to use performance standards if two-thirds of our teachers have not been evaluated yet? What if a teacher has a weak evaluation 1 year, but shows great improvement the next year, but has not had another summative evaluation? In a large district such as ours, how can we equitably compare the evaluations of two different history teachers in two different high schools being observed and evaluated by two different administrators? These are the challenges we face and have talked about when trying to write language based on performance factors. The problem is not evaluating teachers. Teachers should be evaluated. As teachers, we welcome the opportunity to be evaluated and improve our practice. We especially value the opportunity to work in collaboration with our colleagues, including administration, to improve our craft for all children. The problem is the intent of evaluation. DQ believes teacher evaluation is essential and that the purpose of evaluation is to improve teaching and learning. Being observed by a colleague or an administrator and discussing the strengths and weaknesses of your lesson creates an atmosphere of trust and collegiality and improvement. Reducing an evaluation to a label or rank, then creating competition around those rankings for employment, creates an atmosphere of distrust and individualism that is not healthy for schools or children. More teachers are choosing to quit this profession than are being laid off every year. It's time to stop obsessing about how to fire and teachers and layoff procedures and to spend more time supporting teachers and encouraging them to stay in the classroom. Thank you.
Thank you. I would ask in the order I announced earlier, Ms. Glover, Olson, and Chris, if you could all please be at the table and please proceed.
Good morning, and Mr. Chair.
A few minutes each, please.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Jessanna Glover, and I'm with Education Minnesota. Thank you for allowing me to provide testimony on the proposed changes to the teacher layoff provisions of Senate File 97 and House File 2. Our four main concerns are it's not needed. Principals have all the tools they need to remove ineffective teachers, and they should not wait until layoffs to get rid of bad teachers. Number two, school districts and local teachers can already locally negotiate this, and they do. Number three, this bill will lead to costly legal challenges. And number four, this bill is not good for students. We all know a bad teacher. Mine was Mr. Erickson. He sat at his desk. He gave us vocab words, and we spent the hour looking them up. That's the bad teacher, right? Well, that narrative around the bad teacher has ended. He probably wasn't evaluated, but today, under teacher development and evaluation law, he must be evaluated. He must improve. And if he's unwilling or unable to improve, the district must discipline or discharge him. The most dramatic shift in teacher quality is happening right now, as Kate discussed. The 2011 TDE law was created to improve teachers and student learning. By creating a direct link between evaluation and layoff, this bill changes the purpose of evaluation from improvement to competition. This will make every teacher's employment dependent on not just being good or great themselves, but on being better than their colleagues. We know a culture of collaboration and growth will improve student learning. It's the greatest promise of TDE. Who here wants to put at risk improving the quality of thousands of teachers for the benefit of Minnesota students?
Districts and local teachers can already incorporate performance measures into their layoff systems and TDE plans if they want to. Remember, there has never been a round of collective bargaining for teachers where the TDE plans were in place. About 40% of Minnesota school districts have locally negotiated layoff language that go beyond the statutory default seniority. How seniority defined is different throughout the entire state. Don't be fooled that because they use seniority, seniority means the same thing in every district. It does not. And all but approximately 10 districts have locally crafted TDE plans. These bills would force everyone to review and possibly redo their TDE plans as well as negotiate new layoff language, regardless of what they have already agreed was best for their unique district. These bills do not provide a way for teachers to prove their effectiveness category compared to their peers. And shockingly, the amendment at Senate File 97 takes away any due process at all. Because effectiveness categories are private personnel data on individual teachers, this system is not transparent. Teachers are concerned with bias, quality of evaluators, and administrators playing favorites. Those are real concerns. Layoffs under these bills will lead to legal challenges. Layoffs based on license and seniority provide a predictable, reliable, and credible layoff system for a district. It's an especially good layoff system for a district that actually uses tools like evaluation and discharge to get rid of bad teachers. And lastly, there are real things happening in our schools, and there's nothing in these bills that will address the teacher shortage crisis or the real reasons why teachers are leaving the profession in dramatic numbers. There's nothing in here that will improve the quality of teaching and learning for Minnesota students, which is tragic given all the needs our students are bringing to the classroom every day.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Wieger and Committee. My name is Jody Olson. I'm an Education Issues Specialist at Education Minnesota. During the course of the past year, I've been working primarily on aspects of the teacher development and evaluation law with school districts. After every interaction with educators, whether it was one phone call or training teachers and administrators in sessions that held 60 people, I was proud to be an educator in Minnesota. Here are some of the things I've learned. Joint teams of teachers and administrators took the TDE law very seriously. They worked diligently to understand the components and complexity of the statute. These same teams were very responsible in framing a TDE plan that fit their district. We know that flexibility and local control is a Minnesota hallmark, but it can also provide challenges when groups need to come to an agreement. I saw persistence and models of collaboration that I think at times even surprised the teachers and administrators in the room. Many teachers are opening their doors to their classroom and participating in a peer review process for the first time. Most of my work over the past year has been leading groups of teachers and administrators through peer review training. We spend most of the first part of the day just discussing the importance of to build a foundation of relational trust in their schools. Once this is established, educators can approach the peer review process with a growth mindset rather than fear. During these trainings, teams worked carefully and thoughtfully to frame their peer review focused on growth. At the end of these days, I left their communities with the belief that the hard work and collaboration in that room could expand through their schools and would, and impact those in the building in need of it most, our students. 30 years of research shows that relational trust among colleagues leads to improved collective decision-making, engaged reform, and most importantly, student learning. This is the foundation for all of the TDE trainings we've conducted. Increased trust that leads to collaboration directly impacts our students who are at the center of this policy. I urge you to consider the importance of collaboration and how it will be impacted by components of the bill in front of you, specifically using TDE ratings in the consideration of layoffs. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Chris?
Cindy Crist, Minnesota Association of Colleges for Teacher Education. I want to speak to the licensure provisions in Senate File 97 and House File 2, unsurprisingly. My primary message would be that we would like to see the provisions in Senate File 559, as discussed last night, be substituted for all of the licensure provisions in these two bills. As noted last night, and I think Senator Claussen, the author, would be the first to say this, nobody's suggesting that his bill is perfect. But I think nearly everybody who spoke last night indicated that they thought it did strike a good balance between maintaining high standards and providing greater flexibility. Since I can't be confident that that's what will happen, I do want to address a few specific provisions in the two bills. There's one provision in Senate File 97 that I don't think was discussed earlier, unless I missed it. It's on page 2, and it would add language in lines 2.6 and 2.7, specifying that those in alternative programs teaching under a two-year limited-term license, for those individuals, that limited-term license would not be a provisional license. When Ms. Doan testifies shortly, she can correct me if I don't get this quite right, but I believe that change means that those candidates would be able to continue to teach and be licensed regardless of their completion of or performance in that program. I don't believe that's a standard we would want to set. In House File 2, there are three specific provisions I would like to address. The first on lines 9.27 and 9.28, there's language that would be added saying that the Board of Teaching may issue a standard license on the basis of teaching experience and examination requirements alone. Minnesota has never been a state that's been willing to license on the basis of testing. Let me give you just one specific example of what I think would be problematic about that. And I'm thinking about the work that former Senator Saltzman led several years ago to amp up our requirements in the area of reading. If somebody was licensed under these provisions, they would not have to have had that deeper, richer, important preparation in reading that the bill she helped pass would require. And that's just one of many examples I could give. The next issue is the language in House File 2 about non-licensed community experts. We think it would be setting a very bad precedent to take the responsibility for these individuals, to take away from the Board of Teaching responsibility to improve the request to hire these people and simply allow districts to hire them and report that to the Board of Teaching. While it's quite correct that, as an early testifier or two said, that there's a relatively small number of individuals currently teaching with these as non-licensed community experts, part of that may be because of the process that requires districts to demonstrate that they have advertised the position, they have initially sought fully licensed teachers before hiring a non-licensed community expert, and it requires currently that districts, if they want to continue that person, they come back and provide appropriate evidence to the Board of Teaching that things are working well in that respect. Some of my K-12 colleagues have suggested that what we need more of in all of this is trust. And while I'm not lacking in trust in the teachers in our schools or the administrators in our schools, I think the principle of trust but verify is important, and I think this is a place where that should play out. So I believe we should continue to require that these individuals, that their hiring be approved by the Board of Teaching. Finally, there's a provision, there's a matter of one word, one tiny little word, but I think it's a very important one. This is a provision that was discussed in another context last evening. It appears in on lines 4. In line 4.27 in House File 2, this is Section 1, Subdivision 4, Part O. That language in both bills sets forth a number of potential ways for an individual to demonstrate, an individual coming from out of state, to demonstrate that they should be considered for licensure. In Senator Claussen's bill, in the middle of that list, is the word and. And in House File 2, in the same place, is the word or. And if technically we all know what and or mean, right? But sometimes in a list that meaning can vary or can be lost. I believe in this case that if the word used is or, as it is in House File 2, that would mean that the board would have to consider, for example, only depth of content knowledge in making a decision about licensing an out-of-state applicant. I don't believe that is what we would want. I don't think we would want them to not also consider other things like professional development, contribution to the field, completion of a state-approved teacher preparation program. So we believe that one word and on line 4.11 in Senate File 559 is a very important change from the word or in House File 2.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'll ask the next three testifiers to join. Welcome to each of you. Start with Mr. Hasselton.
Hello, Chairman Weger and committee members. I'm Alex Hasselton, a constituent of SUN District 63. I'm an AP Human Geography teacher in Minneapolis Public Schools, and I'm here to testify in opposition to Senate File 97. I'm honored to be here, and I appreciate the opportunity to be part of the process. This is my sixth year as a teacher. I've experienced the turmoil of being laid off, rehired, actually in the same spring. It was it's a budget thing. That's a lot of what private sector employees experience as well. Budget concerns were determining what my job would be. And I want to clarify what seniority is to me as a teacher. It's not an entitlement. It's a backup system if districts can't find a solution. I think that seniority is transparent. Nepotism, differential treatment, and the relationship with administrators really should not determine the career path of committed education professionals. It is also fair. It treats all educators equally. It does not discriminate based on age, race, gender, and sexual orientation. We need to make sure layoffs can process must be different from the evaluation process. I really want my administrators to know that I'm a good teacher. I want them to see me teach. But I want my advocacy on behalf of students not to be what influences my evaluation or my position next year. When it comes to academic freedom, I need the assurance when I teach the Israeli-Palestinian conflict that I'm protected and my students learn. Teachers want a peer-reviewed evaluation process, professional to professional, is what I've experienced, and it improves my teaching. Students really should not be the subjects of political experimentation. Teachers are the most important element of students' experience in their schools. Yeah, it's teachers. But students need stability. And furthermore, I'm a graduate of Augsburg College, and I left my College of Education with the tools and experience in urban classrooms from elementary, middle, high school, and actually adult programs for immigrants newly arrived to Minneapolis. And I left there knowing the challenges that I would face and humble enough to know that I didn't know everything coming into my first year teaching and that I would have a lot to learn too. The profession right now, we're facing teacher shortages, but community experts are not the solution. Minneapolis Public Schools actually hired a firm to find teachers from other states, evidenced through so many of them at the new teacher orientation last August. And the current process works better than emphasizing the use of community experts without training. The profession is not attractive because teachers are shamed and we are blamed. We work tirelessly to teach our students the skills and the knowledge they need to be successful in our 21st century. Minnesota is known for having high professional standards. So why are we messing with these standards? How will we meet the demand for students that need us the most? Students involved in special education programs and students that are English language learners. We need to focus on the needs of the students instead of playing political games with the teaching profession. All teachers need legislation that respects them enough to make this profession attractive. I didn't know everything after I earned my way into this profession, and I needed my colleagues with experience to help me. Show me the battery of peer-reviewed studies and unequivocal information that demonstrates seniority hurts student achievement. Why are teachers the target when we know this bill doesn't move the needle forward on student success? Who will teach the children of Minnesota? I hope it will be people that are committed to this profession, and I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. My name is Derek Olson. I live in Stillwater. I'm here. I'm the 2008 Minnesota Teacher of the Year and a member of the Minnesota chapter of the National Network of State Teachers of the Year. Relevant to this testimony, I have co-authored research on teacher quality and I'm currently finishing my dissertation on teacher evaluation. and I teach graduate courses in the education department at the University of Wisconsin-River Falls. More importantly, I'm in my 24th year of teaching elementary school in Minnesota, the first 10 in St. Louis Park, and the last bit in Stillwater, where, by the way, on a side note, I've had the opportunity to teach Senator Housley's wonderful children, and I think that her tireless volunteering in my classroom was probably great grounds for getting ready to be a senator, because she was a wonderful room mother. Most importantly, I am the parent of three kids who attend public schools here in Minnesota, and there's nothing more than I want for my children than a quality teacher in each and every one of their classrooms. Research is clear, and as I think every testifier agrees, quality teachers matter. But I don't think this bill is the answer, for two main reasons. First, I am concerned that taking a TDE plan, one intended to develop teacher quality and evaluate a teacher's growth, and use it in ways it was not intended to make high-stakes decisions by attempting to rank teachers in order to determine unrequested leave. There's a significant issue of reliability and validity. The TDE plans are not adequately designed to accomplish this task. They weren't designed for it. The actual title of my dissertation, and excuse me, it's long and boring like most dissertation titles, is Award-Winning Teachers' Perspectives on the Characteristics of Teacher Quality as Reflected in Charlotte Danielson's Framework for Teaching. I mention this because the evaluation observation tool in the Minnesota default TDE plan is based on Danielson's framework. In fact, it's the most commonly used observation tool not only in the state, but in the country and is used worldwide. And I believe it was, and forgive me if I have the name wrong, Mr. Erickson did a nice job in his testimony of summarizing the domains in Charlotte's tool. I've spent much of the past 3 years familiarizing myself with research on teacher quality and teacher evaluation, and specifically on Danielson's framework. As I've gotten to know Charlotte Danielson personally over the few years, I called her to find out her thoughts on Minnesota considering using evaluations based on her tool in this way. She called me right back. She had serious concerns, and I wish I could replicate her English accent, but I can't. "The devil is in the details, Derek," she told me, and pointed out if this bill goes forward in the current state of things, she predicts that in no time there will be a flood of legal cases of released teachers with strong arguments that a system with little reliability or validity using scores that would not stand up to statistical analysis were used to make high-stakes decisions. Again, this is the opinion of the creator of the tool itself. There are many recent research studies that demonstrate the extreme difficulty in correlating summative teacher evaluations with actual teacher quality and student achievement. These studies range from the large measures of effective teaching study, the largest of its kind, which analyzed thousands of teachers, to the work of experts like Linda Darling-Hammond. Secondly, I'm concerned that using TDE plans to make high-stakes decisions as determining the rank order of unrequested leaves will actually decrease the factors that lead to increased teacher quality, which is the exact opposite of our shared goal of making all teachers better. Tonight I'm flying to D.C. to present tomorrow at the National Teaching and Learning Conference on research that I co-authored, and I'll just read the title of this as well, From Good to Great, Exemplary Teachers Share Perspectives on Increasing Teacher Effectiveness Across the Career Continuum. This is research that, by the way, was sponsored by nonpartisan organizations including the National Council on Teacher Quality and the Council of Chief State School Officers. It's research that it's the largest survey, by the way, to date of award-winning teachers. And according to the findings, the things that exemplary teachers stated helped them get from being novice to good was being mentored by an experienced teacher, collaborating with experienced teacher. More interestingly, we also found that what helped good teachers go to great was providing those very services to newer teachers, being a mentor, working collaboratively with young teachers. In other words, collaboration and working together with peers is what makes all teachers better, moves everyone up the career continuum towards being a high-quality teacher. But if teachers have to compete with each other to keep their job, that culture of collaboration, instead of growing, will diminish, and I am concerned that will happen if this bill passes. I believe every parent in this room, Republican, Democrat, or otherwise, wants the best for their child, and that includes a great teacher. Therefore, before you consider a bill that would endorse making high-stakes decisions like releasing teachers using evaluation tools that were not designed for that purpose, before you consider a bill that will replace teacher collaboration with teacher competition, I ask you to look closely at the research and also not to confuse politics with logic, emotions with fact, and wishful thinking with reality. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Ms. Stone.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. You've been more than gracious with hearing my thoughts over the last 2 weeks, and so I will be brief. Just a point to really echo Ms. Christ's sentiments in that the Board of Teaching really applauds the efforts in Senate File 559 to come to a balanced compromise, and we would prefer seeing the elements that direct licensure changes in that bill move forward. It is our opinion that House File 2 goes too far on many of these measures. Just for a point of clarification, licensure is really conducted through two agencies. Educator licensing issues licenses based on policy. The Board of Teaching responds to licensure appeals on behalf of candidates. Knowing that, I would hope that some of the decisions that you've heard or some of the scenarios you've heard from candidates would have been reversed when coming to the Board of Teaching. I think that's the outcome that we're all looking for once all the evidence has been considered. What you haven't heard at this point is that the Board of Teaching has identified changes to the process that guides licensure and those that need statutory change, and we have collaborated with stakeholders both inside and outside of this room to try and make that happen. We will continue to do that regardless of the direction legislation takes. Finally, just a couple more items. On page 12 of House File 2, there's a point that I don't think we've yet discussed, which is that a change that program instructors would be able to teach in teacher preparation on only a bachelor's degree. The Board of Teaching has just finished a 7-year rulemaking initiative. 7 years, not because it was such a terribly arduous or delayed process, but one that was very inclusive of stakeholders to make sure there was broad agreement on what was necessary for teacher preparation in Minnesota. As a result of that process and 7-year rulemaking initiative, there was broad agreement that teachers in our teacher preparation programs must have master's level education and then, you know, possibly higher education than that. The concern is not that someone with a bachelor's degree might not have something to lend to the teaching profession, but really that broad level of teacher education, the expectations that are required, really insists that there must be experience that's paired with that as well, not always found in those who are new college graduates. Beyond that, I'll touch finally on the community expert idea. The expansion of the community experts is not something that the Board of Teaching supports. Is not seen as a solution to addressing standards. Making adjustments to the permissions that are already in place to work with licensed or personnel who have some training in teacher preparation or in their content area would be seen as the appropriate compromise. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you. Ms. Gagnon? And then we're going to open it for about 10 minutes for any questions of the testifiers.
Hi, good morning. I'm Rebecca Gagnon. I am a mother of three, and I am a citywide school board member in Minneapolis Public Schools in my fifth year of service. And I want to thank you for bringing up this topic, and Senator Bonhoff, I really appreciate that you continue to push this conversation, because as school board members and school districts, we need to continue to figure out how to negotiate flexibility so that we can ensure we have the most effective teachers in our classrooms. So thank you very much. I do believe, however, since I said negotiated, that this is a local control issue. If our evaluation systems truly work and serve the intended purpose of identifying and addressing the specific professional development needs of our educators to ensure we create and support the best teaching force to meet the unique and diverse needs of our students, then we are strongly positioned to retain greatness and remove ineffective educators on an ongoing basis, which is what we need to do. Then if or when we enter another unfortunate period requiring us to reduce our staff, there would be no great layoff choices, because we would have done our job to ensure that we only retain effective educators. In that case, experience, which we know does matter, will be a good and fair measurement to determine who we retain, especially with the other flexibilities that we in Minneapolis Public Schools have negotiated with our teachers' union. I'm strongly in support of hiring and retention flexibilities, which is why our board has negotiated teacher contracts that don't rely upon seniority as the sole factor for hiring and placement. We have interview and select, which four senior teachers and four other teachers enter a pool for every single open position. An interview happens, and the best person is selected for the job. We have early hiring and retention for hard-to-fill licensure areas like English learners, bilingual staff, special ed, and secondary math are a few. We have protections for teachers in particular licensure areas like Montessori and IB. We have no forced teacher placements at priority schools and in the future at our new community partnership schools. We've also expedited our PSP, which is our professional support process or due process, and the PAR or peer assistance review, which is required under state statute, has been broadened to include an expedited PSP process in cases where the mentor assessment deems a need to move quickly and provide intensive supports. That means we're moving folks out more quickly, which has been one of the big complaints, that the process just takes too long. I'm concerned that this changes the focus of evaluations from creating the world's best educating force to requiring us to create an arbitrary ranking system to determine layoffs. We strongly support evaluations, and we're the first district to overhaul our system and implement rigorous and comprehensive principal and teacher evaluations. We began phasing in this process the 11-12 school year at turnaround schools under federal law, and fully implemented the 13-14 school year at all schools with all educators. And this, I assure you, has been a learning process. And in my humble experience, our teacher and principal evaluations are still developing, need improvement, and more data collection is needed to ensure fidelity. So yes, there might come a time that layoffs happen because we are downsizing. However, MPS has been hiring more teachers the past few years, hiring over 300 this school year, and looking at the same need moving into 15-16 school year. This is due to retirements, which are happening more often, increased need in special ed and English learner teacher licensure areas, reopening 7 schools, expanding 6 schools to address overcrowding because our student population is growing, and the contract flexibilities I spoke about earlier that allow us to expedite due process and move out teachers unable or unwilling to provide effective classroom instruction. Focusing on seniority and LIFO in these bills during layoffs due to downsizing does nothing to address the urgency for effective instruction in every classroom right now. The evaluation process is helping us get there in Minneapolis. Our negotiated flexibilities are also helping us get there. Let us continue to do the work we have been elected to do, authorized by statute to do, and that you will, I'm quite certain, continue to hold me responsible for. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Okay, we'll now open it up for any questions that members may have. We'll go first to Senator Chamberlain.
Oh, I got lucky. Actually,
you were fast.
I jumped.
You were fast.
Mr. Chair, I was had a question for Mr. Derek Olson. He was just previously up. Is he still there?
Yes, Mr. Olson.
Well, he's coming up the table. Mr. Olson and others had mentioned something about competition, and Mr. Olson specifically mentioned competition and versus collaboration. My question, Mr. Olson, is it your contention that competition and collaboration cannot work together in the environment?
Mr. Olson?
Chairman, Senator, I believe that in many situations competition and collaboration can work together. We see it in so many ways. If I want my students in my classroom to collaborate, to be motivated to do something, there would be many situations where they will collaboratively in groups compete against other groups, and that competition creates an incentive. What I'm referring to use an example right now, in our hallway, there's 6 teachers. One of them is a new teacher. She has been very reflective in wanting to get better, and as a first-year teacher, she's needed help to get better, and she's been very, very, very receptive to and asking, and we've been very supportive in helping her grow and be from being a pre-service teacher now to a novice teacher, and hopefully into soon a great teacher, and that her skills will match her enthusiasm soon. But quite honestly, in conversations about this bill with the people in my hallway that have been trying to nurture her and support her, and I'm not speaking for myself, but I literally here have, you know, people's comments is, why would I help people if it potentially puts my job on the line. And right now, the idea is we want to help, you know, you grow so much from that, learning from people that are experienced. The gentleman who testified right next to me talked about knowing he didn't know everything and what he learned from others. So we need to foster that sense of collaboration. We need to, the problem is, quite honestly, this is the perfect time place to mention it, that collaboration, mentorship, mentoring programs cost money, and they're not happening the way they should. If we want to have higher quality teachers across the board, we should be funding the things that help make teachers better, like creating solid mentoring programs, making it easier for peer evaluations to happen, not for the purpose of ranking, but for me not to just go into a classroom across the hall, but one across the district to watch someone who's an expert at what I'm teaching. Right now, there's not the money for that. But I think I'm digressing from your question. I'm sorry. But trying to get back to it, I do think they can work together, but I think that this bill creates a situation where there will be a sense of competition and a fear for job security that will decrease the incentive of teachers of wanting to work together. It can be a lonely profession, and if we're isolated in our classrooms with the door closed and have reinventing the wheel to stay one step ahead in our students' achievement of the teacher across the hall or next door, that isn't going to help raise the quality of teachers in our classrooms, and that's what we want.
One quick follow-up, Mr. Chair.
One quick one.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Olson. Well, I think what we're losing here is a larger picture. I do not think they're mutually exclusive. This cell phone, the car I drive, and pretty much everything we have on is a product of competition, but it's also a product of collaboration. I haven't worked anywhere where you didn't work in teams with people that are your equal, and you want to make them better. Because ultimately, whoever made this phone, you know, or Apple phones, their goal is to serve the customer the best they can. And I think, if I may dare say, is that the competition and collaboration you're working on as a team in a school is for the student, not against each other. But you should be working for that student to produce the best student possible. So I do not think collaboration and competition are mutually exclusive. I think they go hand in hand, and they give us something. It's not something to be scared of. It's simply not something to be scared of, because the end game is getting the best kids out the door with the best education. Thank you for your time. Thanks.
Chairman Center, you mentioned that was a follow-up question, so can I respond to the follow-up question?
Yes.
Okay. The difference, I believe, in your analogy and where I believe it falls short is the competition with your phone that Apple has is not within the Apple company. It's with other companies. Within my school, the competition shouldn't be between me and the person across the hall. That's the team that worked to put together your phone. We don't want them working in competition with each other. Thank you, Senator Chairman.
Mr. Chair.
I would ask if the authors could yield to committee members, and you'll have a chance to have closing comments. Senator Stump.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, one of the charges that we have as a legislative body is to provide equal education system, equal across the whole state. And one of the things that I didn't hear either side or anyone talk about is the opportunities that rural school districts and other districts that are not sharing in the quality improvement programs that were put in place under Governor Pawlenty. And I heard people say, well, the teacher evaluation system is fully implemented. Strong teacher evaluation system is in place. How can you have a strong teacher evaluation system when school districts, less than half of the school districts, only about 50-some school districts are getting $260 more per pupil than all of the rest of the schools across the state? Senator Dames, you and I should be mad as hell that our districts are being shortchanged. Mm-hmm. How can we participate in the same kind of programs, mentoring or hiring substitutes or all of the things that is needed for helping these young teachers that come out of schools? So I'm very upset that the organizations that are supposed to represent all the districts don't come out stronger in favor of the type of equal treatment among all the school districts that they should. And it's not just the teacher evaluation, $260. It's also large districts here in the metropolitan area are spending over $5 per square foot for facilities. And all the rest of the districts, the smaller districts, are spending a little over $2 per square foot. And if you don't have the facilities, you don't have equity in our education system either.
Okay, point noted. Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I do want to hear the author's response to my question, which builds very much on what Senator Stomp just said. I have been dealing with this issue for the last 8 years, and I thought when I got elected to the Senate that we had to do something about this issue, and I got into really trying to read and study what's going on. So what I have learned in the last 8 years is that Minnesota really does not have a system in place to provide the support and the induction that is necessary, and that research clearly articulates need to be in place for new teachers for at least 3 years. We don't have that in place. We never talk about what is that we have in place today to support the newest teachers who deal with the most challenging circumstances today. We have issues going on in urban settings and in rural settings. Very different challenges, but we have challenges. We have not talked about the cost and the opportunity that we have to invest in that. Then we really have not talked about what this evaluation system does, because what it does is that it really provides us with an opportunity to say, okay, where are things working and where are things not working, so that we really have to figure out a process to address those issues that are not working for teachers, right? The cost associated with an induction system that truly supports teachers so that they can stay in the classroom and truly does evaluation of teachers is about $250 million. And I can tell you exactly how it works. The Bush Foundation invested $30 million trying to figure out for 6 years how this will work. So we know the cost of it. It's about $250 million. So Senator Pratt and Senator Bonner, my question to you is, knowing that teachers, principals, districts, professionals, experts know that what we need is an induction system, a training system, a support system, an evaluation system. Please tell me where seniority fits, where contract and seniority system pieces fit into that system of induction and evaluation.
Senator Torres, I'm going to ask that they hold on the response. I'd like to use this opportunity to question any of the testifiers, and we'll be talking a lot to one another over the next several weeks. But if you could hold on to that question, and if we could direct our questions now to the testifiers, but we will get to that for sure in our discussion. We have Senators Dahl, Kiffmeyer, and Peterson.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment or two. In terms of, I know we think of the coin flip or the file folder number as horrible, like it's between the best teacher in the school and the worst. Actually, my best friend in Northfield, we both were hired the same day 21 years ago. He's a Northfield Teacher of the Year. I'm Northfield Teacher of the Year. We're both semifinalists for Teacher of the Year. And you know what? We have a file folder number. If we had to lay off one of us, he would say, I should be retained. I would say he should be retained. But, so it isn't the worst case scenarios on those determining, how we might have to do a layoff. I mean, there are things in language like that. I had a town meeting in New Prague this last Saturday, and I had a teacher show up, a 15-year teacher. And you know what? He's never been involved in politics. He felt he had to come to this town meeting, and when he spoke, he was shaking because he'd watched 6 hours of testimony at the House floor, and everyone stood up. I really like the teachers we have in our community, but, and then they rip the profession to shred. And as a teacher for 31 years, I feel that we have been under attack, that we have been under siege for years. And we are going to have a teacher shortage. I think of those small communities, and I taught in one, a town of 600 for 9 years, that people go there with a little bit of security regarding tenure. In fact, that they put up their stakes there. They build their families there. They're involved in so many, and they're some of the most respected people in those communities. But you know what? Don't tell me that me at $68,000 a year or that new guy at $34,000 a year with the kind of budget decisions that we're faced, I'm sorry, your performance was just 1 point worse than that other guy. Thanks for your service. And you know what? Me at $68,000, I can't get another job. There's no way that someone's going to pay me. Sorry, the best we can give you is 6 years' experience. That's what we have. That's what we've been doing for years. There's a little bit about this profession that pays so little to start, but you build on and say, I can actually have a family. I can maybe send my kids to school because I put my time in. And you know what? We should get rid of bad teachers. As a member rights person, dozens of teachers have found their way out the door with the help of administrators and the unions themselves. I never want to defend a bad teacher. But I want you to say our profession is under attack, and this is one more bill. That's what I'm telling you the teachers are telling me in my community. That's what people are telling me across Senate District 20, that why are we under attack? You ask anybody, parents around your communities, what do you think of your teachers? You know what they're going to say? They're great teachers. They're good people. They're doing the best job that they can in our school. So I'm sorry. The points that the Teacher of the Year made regarding competition and collaboration are on. I will help the new person, but I know some people across in another building say, sorry, I'm going to hold in my best lessons to myself because, you know what, you may be the guy replacing me in a couple years. So I hope we... I hope we get this right. I hope that locally we can decide these particular issues among ourselves. That's the only way you're going to get teacher buy-in. But this top-down approach saying this is how it's going to be, you're not going to get the teacher buy-in. You've got to get the people in the profession to say this is how we want to do it. And I'm willing to lead that discussion as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Dahl. Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question for Mr. Samuels, Don Samuels.
Yes.
He's still here.
School board member Samuels
here? He's not here any longer.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Is there... Okay. Well, let's see. Well, Mr. Chairman, since I have an opportunity...
You do.
The reason why I wanted to hear Mr. Samuels was two things. One, with his malfunction of his technology, I wanted to give him an opportunity to finish, and it wasn't his fault. He had prepared, but because of the interference, and so I wanted to be sure that he had... Maybe he could be... asked to submit his comments and more entirely because of that, and that might be helpful. Secondly, I especially want to talk to him because inner city Minneapolis, Minneapolis School Board, is such a crucial area. And when someone comes with such passion and care and takes this and makes the comments that he did, we need to take that seriously. Yeah, I think he's putting himself right in there by being in the neighborhood,
yes,
and has personal experience with all of that. But I saw this legislation more as allowing the local school districts to include this, not as a mandate for them, but that there would be local contracts, local bargaining, local agreements, and state law would get out of the way and let them do that on the local negotiations. So, but if we can also have Mr. Samuels more fully submit his comments, I think that would be good.
Yes, he would be welcome to do that, and okay, that'll be communicated. Thank you. Senator Pierce.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do just want to say, for the record, I don't feel as though the back and forth with the testifiers and the members in committee is very conducive to back and forth dialogue. The testifiers that we had for, an hour brought up a myriad of issues, and as a member, it is impossible to sort of dig into those things. And Senator Torres Ray had a question yesterday. I had a question, and it just doesn't seem that there's any coherent way to dig into the issue given the format. With that said, To the issue, issues primarily in Senate File 97, I think it's worth pointing out that Senate File 97 actually expands local control. It doesn't limit local control. The entire reason that we're having the conversation around Senate File 97 is because of existing statute, existing state mandates on 122A 40 and 41 lay out a whole plethora of constructions around labor law and what the state, you know, forces districts to do and the manner in which they deal with due process and all of these sorts of things. And then as it relates to the unrequested leave process, as every member knows, there's a default position in favor of seniority that means that no district has the ability to negotiate the issue, which is the fundamental sort of issue around local control. So the reason this kind of approach, the reason back in 2011 House File 945 was constructed in the way that it was specifically to address the current state mandates with regard to labor under the Continuing Contract Law and the Tenure Act. So not only that, but the underlying framework for Senate File 97 is itself locally developed in many situations. So the teacher evaluation framework for the districts who didn't use the model are using an underlying system that was also locally developed. So this is a bill that supports local control if you're concerned about that. I suspect that's not really the real sort of issue that's at play here. I'll also say this, that with regard to unrequested leave, I think it's important for everybody to acknowledge, and I think everybody does, is that it's an unfortunate circumstance that nobody wants the layoff process to happen. Preferably, we would never have to go about laying off any of the teachers. So it's not a question of whether one side wants to lay off teachers and another side doesn't want to lay off teachers. Both sides acknowledge that this process at times is going to take place when there's either declining enrollment or funding issues or things of that nature. So it's a false sort of choice or narrative to put out there that sort of there's one group of people that are attacking teachers and another group that aren't attacking. There's, in this scenario, it's a one for one, right? There's one teacher who will stay, presumably, and one who won't. So then the question is, in that unfortunate circumstance, which nobody's rooting for to happen, what outcome best serves the interests of students? And if you're looking at it from that view, a student-centric view, rather than worrying about what is in the best interest of the adults in the room, you would say, well, let's do everything we can to see who is actually having an impact on students' lives in a more positive way. That's what it's about. And to the issue, frankly, of people saying that the, you know, people are under attack and we're quote unquote obsessed with this issue. This is the first hearing this year that I've been in where we talked about it. You know, we've had hundreds of hours of debate and testimony on a whole number of issues. Thank you, Senator Wieger, for hearing those things. We've debated nutrition. We've debated length of the school day, when the school day is going to start. We've talked about placement and licensure. We've talked about... So the only people that I hear from that are quote-unquote outraged about attacking teachers are the union and frankly, most of the DFL members who speak about it. Because it's a narrative that provides a wedge, frankly, for them to get folks riled up. Nobody's talking about that. I've never heard anybody that is advocating for these bills attacking teachers. But at the core of the issue with regard to Senate File 97 is there is going to be a layoff. Unfortunately, there is going to be a layoff. In that event, do you think that we ought to do what we can to keep the best person in the position? In seniority, if your narrative is such that you want local control, fine. There's a remedy for that as well. We can eliminate the seniority backup within the statute under Subdivision 11. That's, you know, if we want to go there. But I take issue with sort of, and then the underlying other assertions about, you know, teachers are under attack, but it's perfectly okay to impugn the motives of anybody who suggests reform. You know, you could never say the same thing about our teachers, and I don't want to, by the way. But anybody who suggests more student-centric reform is bad, is making emotional decisions or political decisions. How about this? How about we all came to the table as honest brokers that have a difference of opinion about what serves the best interests of students? Can we just have that conversation without sort of people being cast, you know, as ignorant or political or hating on, you know, because that's really nonsense. And I frankly don't believe that members on either side here actually walk into committee with malice. I actually think that Senator Dahl and Senator Torres-Ray honestly believe their positions are in the best interest of students. And I think the same for Senator Bonhoff and Senator Pratt. So that's all I have.
How about me? No, I'm just everybody else.
What about her?
All right.
Thank you, Sarah Pearson. Members, it's our intent, and I discussed this with the respective authors, that this will be, each bill be laid over for possible inclusion. We'll have everyone an opportunity to further discuss this, to invite additional comments on this. I'll ask, and we do have actually, you know, some of the language in here. We've discussed this in other bills. Senator Rosen's bill on revocation of license, that's pretty much agreed to, at least I would expect that. That's in House File 2, provisions on licensure. We reached a great agreement last night that Senator Claussen has worked on with Senator Pratt on. There's the placement of teacher issue. We're going to hear about that very soon, a compromise language that's been developed. So there's a number of progress that's being made in different parts, albeit there's a debate ahead on other items, but it's not like some of these things have been on hold. There's is progress being made on a number of items and, you know, through the discussion. So I'll ask Senators Pratt and Bonhoff to give a one-minute summation, then we're going to go to Senator Kent's bill after I lay these on the table. Senator Bonhoff, you had the bill first, so...
All right, members, just to respond to the comments around the table, I agree with Senator Stump. In fact, last year I carried a bill that said any non-QComp district should get the $260 per pupil, and I am a co-author of the same bill too, because I think with the teacher evaluation system, we have to give our districts the resources to implement that, and my districts support that. They are QComp districts, and they applaud that effort. With regard to Senator Torres-Ray, absolutely, we should have a strong induction system. The funny thing is, Teach for America probably does the best job because their teachers for 2 years meet every single week and on Saturdays to get follow-up coaching. They get videotaped. They get all sorts of things. So the woman who testified last night when she talked about her three teachers beating the odds, what she didn't say is they were Teach for America teachers. So that, while that doesn't relate to the bill, I just wanted it said. With regard to this, the last thing I want you to know is that there's no bell curve. Sometimes it gets talked about like we're going to have a bell curve and there's going to be a, you know, equal numbers of low performing, high performing, and then in the middle. There's no stipulation for that. You could have an entire building that's rated highly effective and then they would do seniority. So it really is up to the local school districts. We really advocate for each and every teacher to be highly effective. We just want to make sure that when there's a layoff, the best teachers stay in the classroom. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Bonhoff. Senate File 97 will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you. And Senator Pratt?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. A few things, and to agree with Senator Bonhoff that we do need to make sure our schools have the resources not only to implement effective evaluation systems, but to have wages that, in fact, attract teachers to this profession. To Senator Dahl, one of the frustrations I've had for many, many years is that the steps and lane system we have for compensation is antiquated, and we need to relook at that.
This is not about firing teachers, Senator Dahl. This is, and teachers are not under attack. But compensation is a 50, 60, 70-year-old process that needs to be looked at because it is keeping young teachers out of the profession. We talked a lot about high-stakes rating systems, like we talked about high-stakes testing last year. We're not talking about high-stakes rating systems. We're talking about locally developed evaluation systems and allowing those to be used when making very difficult layoff decisions. And I might just differ with Senator Peterson a little bit, as he said we're pitting, or at least I got the sense that we were pitting the needs of the student versus the needs of the adult. I think that Senator Bonhoeff's bill and my bill both respect both. We respect the professionalism of those younger teachers and giving them a fair chance to keep their jobs and build their professions. And so we were told many times not to confuse emotion with facts. Well, the fact is that the status quo is an emotional position, and it's one that's very hard to move off of.
Thank you, Senator Pratt.
Well, Mr. Chair, just a couple more things as I wrap up, please. The other thing is, I've worked with Senator Clausen on a number of bills, and I would have been more than happy to discuss the licensure provisions. Unfortunately, they decided to work with Senator Clausen and not me, even though we had similar language. So I would encourage those advocates and folks working on these issues to work across the aisle and to work with both of us so that we can be more consistent and we can move forward. So, Mr. Chair, I hope the committee will support House File 2.
Thank you, Senator Pratt. House File 2 as amended, just like Senate File 97 as amended, will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And thank you to each of the testifiers. We'll go next to Senate File 1554, Senator Kent, and we'd ask that your testifiers come to the table. This addresses teacher placement. We have a. Is there an amendment?
Was it 12?
Senator Kent.
That was 11.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will make this.
If everyone, we would appreciate if you could talk outside. We appreciate that you're here. Okay, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will try to make this really brief. This is an issue that we've talked about for a couple of years, and I appreciate that Senator Pratt included the idea in HF2. Senate File 54, I think, takes this to the next level, having worked with stakeholders. This is an issue that has the language in this bill is the result of a lot of consultation over a number of years. I want to go back to something that Mr. Olson said when he was talking about the previous bills, about how quality teachers matter. And I think everyone in this room and at this table absolutely agrees with this idea. This bill addresses the ways in which quality teachers matter and how we make a difference with that in terms of our students on a year-in and year-out basis. This is a quick sort of switching of gears because we were talking about layoffs, and in that context, we talked a lot about evaluations. This is really specifically about the evaluation process and what happens with students through that process. I support the teacher evaluation process. It is in the process of being implemented. Senator Stumpf made some very good points, and as a result, we need to take care of students as that is happening. That's what this bill does. What we talk about here is in terms of classroom placement, administrators every single spring make up class lists for the next year, and they look at a number of factors in putting those measures together. They talk about gender, they make sure special education students are balanced throughout classes, they manage where the gifted and talented students land, for example, and what this does is it says in very direct link to the teacher development and evaluation statute that they need to take into consideration that if a student was with a teacher, and I'm going back to the bill language on page 3, if a student in the classroom of a teacher who is in the improvement process referenced in clause 12 or has not had a summative evaluation, then that student should not be placed in a similar situation the next year. It's an awkward way to say it. I apologize. But again, it's awkward because it is so directly linked to the teacher evaluation language, and that's really important. There is a distinction between K through 4, where kids are in one teacher's room the whole day, versus 5 through 12, where their schedules are more mixed. That's one of the developments we've made over the years. And with that, thank you, everybody, for your patience as I've tried to set this up, and I'd like to introduce Paul Winkler from Education Minnesota.
Mr. Winkler.
Chair Wiener, members of the committee, I'm Paul Winkler, and I'm a former ninth grade civics teacher and now work at Education Minnesota. I'm here to testify on behalf of Senate File 1554. Yes, you heard that correctly. We're standing with Senator Bonhoff and Senator Peterson. And I told Senator Kent yesterday, if the rapture comes, it's her fault. But on a serious note, the authors of this bill, Education Minnesota, and all of us know that teachers can have an incredible impact on a student's life. But sometimes a teacher just isn't cutting it, and that can be terrible for a student. The teacher development evaluation is now ensuring that all teachers will be evaluated. While the intention of TDEE is to drive improvement of teachers through development, it also has mandates that districts must take disciplinary action if a teacher is on or an improvement plan and cannot complete it. No one wants their children in a teacher's classroom who is unable to make these improvements and is disciplined for it. But when it happens, we as adults must ensure that it doesn't happen again. This bill does exactly that. In the event that a child was with a teacher who was disciplined, it makes sure that the following year the student is placed with a teacher who is not on an improvement plan. And to prevent even the possibility of that happening, the bill does not allow a student to be placed with a first-year teacher, as they have not been evaluated. Principals already have the ability to place students in the classrooms, but this takes it one step further. It makes them take particular care in making that placement correct for this child. I would like to thank Senator Kent and the authors for listening to our major concerns we have had with previous language from past years that established effectiveness categories. Today we've heard a lot about that, so I won't go on. This bill, I believe, completes the major goal of Senator Kent's previous work in this area to ensure that students are with great teachers. And since all plans must have improvement plans under the statute, this bill can be implemented without redoing TD&E plans. Thank you, Chair Wieger, members of the committee, and Senator Kent for your support of this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Winkler. I would invite anyone that would like to make a statement on this. It's our intent to lay it over with the sense that progress is being made, and with that spirit, we would further examine it next week when we roll out the bill. But we'll ask for any comments, and then it's our intent to go up to session in about 7 minutes.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm Roger Arnson. I represent the Elementary and Secondary Principals Association. Very quickly, we haven't been part of the stakeholder discussions. There are some implementation issues here relative to the mandate. I mean, we know what the spirit of is, what Senator Kent wants to do. We need to talk about this just a little bit as to how this is going to work. You would be surprised how complex the process of student assignment is. Like you can see Senator Claussen nodding his head, there's a lot to it, and we'll visit about that a bit. I would say the other thing, too, is this makes a rule about discipline, that if the teacher got some discipline, then the student couldn't be in the classes 2 weeks. And I was visiting with the two HR directors that were here today. There's a lot of times where there might be some student discipline in the file that has no connection to the teacher's instruction ability and that kind of stuff. And so we could maybe work through that. And we'll continue to work with the author and appreciate that time. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Ms. Doslin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Valerie Doslin. I represent the Minnesota Association of School Administrators. And again, just to echo what I shared briefly in my earlier testimony, I think we share Representative Senator Kent's goal. We just worry about potential unintended consequences, especially in small school districts and small schools where there may be only a few classes in each grade span. And we will be meeting with I understand that there's a provision in there, but looking at that a little more clearly, we think there's some other possible sticky wickets. So we will meet with Senator Kent, and we have a meeting scheduled, and we will work out some of our concerns and questions. Thank you.
And is Ms. Dietrich invited?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Denise Dietrich with the Minnesota School Boards Association. And we just want to make a couple of comments about this. As Mr. Aronson said there, this does get to be a little bit of a logistics quagmire, especially for the middle and high school, and that some of those things will need to be worked out. And Senator Stump's comments earlier, this will be very difficult to have equal statewide implementation, and so that raises a big red flag for us as well. So thank you.
Senator Claussen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to pick up on a couple comments that have already been made on page 3, 3.25, 3.26, secondary schedules can be very complex. And I think there should be Senator Cantor's recommendation that at something on the addition to line 3.26, unless the student's schedule does not allow a teacher. You don't want to change the student's schedule saying you cannot take these classes because there's a teacher that we don't want you to have. The student's request should really drive that issue. So
Mr. Chair and Senator Claussen and to the other testifiers, this has been the result of consultation over years. That is the idea behind the language at the ends of both paragraphs, recognizing that in smaller districts, in smaller schools, in the secondary setting, you do have more complications, and it tries to provide some leeway there. We will certainly be glad to work with people to provide more comfort in that area as possible. But what matters is that this is the idea that students will sort of by luck of the draw, you're going to get a great teacher one year, you may get not the greatest teacher the next year. The challenge is we know that luck of the draw isn't truly random, and there are a lot of efforts that take place to persuade student placement sometimes, and we want to make sure that there are not biases, conscious or otherwise, that make sure lead some students to repeatedly end up in a situation because they're not being advocated for.
Any further comments, questions? Exemplary progress, and Senate File 1554 will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And members, thank you for your thoughtful attention, and we will meet next as a committee on March 18. Prior to that, there's a lot of meetings working on different proposals, as we just noted in our proposals this morning. The draft bill will be shared with each caucus Tuesday morning. It'll be posted tentatively sometime Tuesday afternoon. And we'll have a hearing walkthrough on the omnibus bill on March 18th. And then we'll entertain and hopefully take action by the 19th of March. That's the plan. There being no further business, the committee's adjourned.